Blog Talk Radio.
You have reached the family of Airwaves America. Renaissance Radio presents the Dave and Gisky Rock Show. This is a show where we try to think for ourselves and offer thought-provoking, stimulating, informative, and entertaining discussion. Welcome.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Indeed, this is a Dave and Gisky Rock Show. I don't know why he doesn't put his name first. He's paying, you know. We got a great show. Got a great show for you. Gisky is not going to be joining us. He's got a family thing he's attending to, but that's okay. I'm ready for you. A little later on, I'll have a buddy be able to toss it around with. But I got some stuff that I kind of want to put out there. In the meantime, this is, like I said, Renaissance Radio with Dave and Gisky Rocks. The call-in number, because we like to get some calls rocking here, is 516-387-1705. I will lay that number out again if I see, as needed. If you want to email Gisky, you can get him at GiskyRocks@airwavesamerica.com. He tells me that if you want to email me, it's Dave@airwavesamerica.com. And if I get any emails at that email address, he'll email me at my regular email and say, hey, check your email address at Airwaves America. I have yet to successfully access that account. No biggie. Neither of us have spent any time on it. I'm sure we can figure it out if we, get our heads together. But each of us have so much going on outside of this show. You wouldn't know it because we put on quality content. So this is all we do. We do this one show every week, and it's so good that we spent all week getting prepared for this show. Well, folks, I don't want to burst your bubble. That is not the case. And if you're not picking up on my sarcasm, maybe it's because I'm not laying it on thick enough. But we do. We have a great, great show in the immortal words of Gisky Rocks. We got a great, great show for you. And what it means is we have no idea where the show's going to go. And the good news is, though, that we have faith that it's going to be a great, great show. And, we're just going to push ahead and do what we can to make it such. Like I said, I do have some things that I want to talk about, some current events that'll be coming up a little bit later. But before I do that, I've got some other things that I found in some of my books that I was writing, and I'm gonna dig right in. I found some stuff that I've been meaning to put on the air. Again, because I'm sure I talked about this when we were doing our radio shows before. I have a couple of items, and it's what I always go to when somebody starts arguing, like global warming. You know, it's all so matter of fact, and we hear this from every direction. We hear it from every source. Global warming, and then whatever it is. Now it's climate justice, and stuff like that. when I was writing, this book was, I think, 2010. And that was obviously during the Obama administration. And that was when we probably, that was when I, let's put it this way. That's when I first heard the term cap and trade. And you know, if you talk to, what's his name, Al Gore, he invented this shakedown, as it were, to where companies that produced carbon dioxide in the form of emissions or, you know, whatever byproducts that they have, they could pay a tax and kind of exonerate themselves. So in other words, you can buy your way into heaven. So if they paid, then they were a good polluter because they were still paying. Now, the idea started out that money would go, and I'm going to cover this here in a minute and show you, that money would go to developing countries to help them raise their standards of living and whatnot. But coincidentally, Al Gore is like a billionaire now, isn't he? So I think some of those cap and trade dollars got you know, redirected. Here's what I wrote about it. Cap and trade legislation is global wealth redistribution by design. And this is best illustrated by a portion of an interview with, check it out, Otmar Edenhofer. And he was a leading member of the United Nations IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And Germany had a news outlet called NZZ Online. I think that's just coincidental that it was Germany's and it was NZZ Online. A little too close for a couple of vowels in there. It would make more sense. However, NZZ, here's the question. The new thing about your proposal for a global deal is the stress on the importance of development policy for climate policy. Until now, many think of aid when they hear, quote unquote, development policies. This is how Otmar Edenhofer answered. That will change immediately if global emissions rights are distributed. If this happens on a per capita basis, then Africa will be the big winner, and huge amounts of money will flow there. This will have enormous implications for development policy, and it will raise the question if these countries can deal responsibly with so much money at all. NZZ Online says, that does not sound any more like the climate policy that we know. Edenhofer. Basically, it's a big mistake to discuss climate policy separately from the major themes of globalization. The climate summit in Cancun at the end of the month is not a climate conference, but one of the largest economic conferences since the Second World War. Why? Because we have 11,000 gigatons of carbon in the coal reserves in the soil under our feet, and we must emit only 400 gigatons in the atmosphere if we want to keep the 2-degree target. 11,000 to 400. There is no getting around the fact that most of the fossil reserves must remain in the soil. NZZ Online asked the question, so de facto, this means an expropriation of the countries with natural resources. This leads to a very different development from that which has been triggered by development policy. Edenhofer. First of all, developed countries have basically created the atmosphere of the world community. But one must say clearly that we redistribute de facto the world's wealth by climate policy. Obviously, the owners of coal and oil will not be enthusiastic about this. One has to free oneself from the illusion that international climate policy is environmental policy. This has almost nothing to do with the environmental policy anymore, with problems such as deforestation or the ozone hole. So in other words, whenever they talk about global warming or cap and trade or, you know, any other climate change, you know, new green deals and stuff like that, they're talking about redirecting money, just basically making people pay money. Not just corporations. It's, you know, it's down to, you know, if they charge a big oil company that's, you know, that puts gasoline in the pumps, if they charge them, you know, an extravagant amount for climate policy, and I'll put in parentheses development policy, then who do you think pays for that? They're not paying it. They pass it on in the price of gas. Price of gas right now, I am officially pissed off at the world. I don't talk to anybody that I know voted for Biden. I hardly talk to them at all unless I have to. Because I'm paying, you know, $65 to fill up the tank of my car. That is unbelievable. That is just absolutely unnecessary. That was one of the things that I've been meaning to get to, that whole Otmar Edenhofer, who says the quiet part out loud, and everybody thinks it's about environmental policy. It has nothing to do with environmental policy. They can give a damn. They just want the money. They'll let anybody pollute as long as they're paying the money. And they're going to redirect that. And it has to do with globalization and all that. I think earlier in that same book, Stay Mad, what I was observing is the United States is really the only... It's the only country in on the globe that is standing in the way of global government, and that's because basically it's a we the people thing, and you know we're too smart we're too smart to give in to what we don't need to give in. We're doing fine. We don't need a global government. We don't need to pay global taxes. We need to just, you know, tend to ourselves, mind our business, whatever. The problem is the people who are globalists have figured out some workarounds and they're using them, you know, one of it, which was the 2020 election. That's one of the things. So there was another thing in here that we touched on recently, G-Ski and I. There's so many cool things in this book. I've forgotten a lot of them. I put a marker in there. I got like 53 bookmarks hanging off the top. So now it's not like I have to page through the book to find out what I'm looking for. Now I have to page through the bookmarks to find out which part I want to talk about. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Here we go. G-Ski, if you're listening, This is what we talked about recently. Black liberation theology, and I wrote a little bit about it in 2010, because we became exposed to it because of Al Sharpton, Reverend Wright, a few other people that became prominent when Obama was first coming up. He went to Reverend Wright's church for 20 years and never heard anything anti-American from those things. But we know. We know. Let's see. Black liberation theology founded by a man named James Cone. Okay. Here's the first thing. When I looked it up online. Black liberation theology, and this is what it says, working from a strong Marxist base. Liberation theology teaches that the New Testament Gospels can be understood only as calls for social activism, class struggle, and revolution aimed at overturning the existing capitalist order and installing in its stead a socialist utopia where today's poor will unseat their quote-unquote oppressors and become liberated from their material and consequently their spiritual deprivations. An extension of this paradigm, Black liberation theology, seeks to foment a similar Marxist revolutionary fervor founded on racial rather than class solidarity. That's why it's called I can't even think of what it is now. The only thing I can think of is Black Lives Matter. BLT, Black a theory. Critical race theory, CRT, that's what it is, critical race theory. Boy, that one took longer than it should have. Seeks to foment a similar, okay. Characterizing America as an irredeemably, quote-unquote, racist society. And I got to tell you, I'm reading this for the first time in four or five years, because this may have been a segment that I, got it. I'd flip over, skip over it. Right now, I tell you what, this is exactly what critical race theory has become, and this is where it came from. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know that it was going to become, huge, but I was writing about it, and I did a little bit of research on Black liberation theology. Now it's called critical race theory, and it's based in Marxism and the Black Lives Matter founders. They are openly Marxist. Well, that came from this. They admittedly openly Marxist. Well, that's comes from Black liberation theology. Bigfoot's in the house. Hey, Big, what's going on? Just me tonight. G-Ski's listening, probably on his phone. He's going to get in trouble because he's listening while he's out to dinner having his daughter's birthday or something. So I, you know how good that. He says, I'm going to try to listen. I'm like, yeah, right. They're going to say, why did you put that phone down? Why do you have those earbuds in? I've been talking to you for the last 5 minutes. What are you doing? Huh? What? Huh? That's how those go. That's how those things go. All right. So his name that founded Black Liberation Theology, James Cone. And he argues, here we go, because this is all going to be familiar. James Cone argues that white people traditionally have exploited Christianity as an opiate of the black masses. He asserts that the destitute, quote, are made and kept poor by the rich and powerful few, unquote, and that no one can be a follower of Jesus Christ without a political commitment that expresses one's solidarity with victims. So claiming that, quote unquote, black values are superior to American values, Cone's writings posit a black Jesus who leads African Americans as the chosen people. Okay, African Americans. Okay, Jesus was in Israel. There was no America at the time. All right, anyways. I'm like I said, I'm reading this for the first time in 4 or 5 years, and you know, things hit you. It's hitting different, that's all. So this country was founded for whites, and everything that has happened in it has emerged from the white perspective, he writes. What we need is the destruction of whiteness, which is the source of human misery in the world. In 1969, Cone characterized white society as the Antichrist and the white church as an institution that was racist to its core. Thus, he posited a desperate need for a black theology, a theology whose sole purpose is to apply the freeing power of the gospel to black people under white oppression. Let's see here. In his landmark 1969 book, Black Theology and Black Power, Cone wrote, "The time has come for white America to be silent and listen to black people. All white men are responsible for white oppression." This is quotes from his book. Theologically, Malcolm X was not far wrong when he called the white men the devil. Any advice from whites to blacks on how to deal with white oppression is automatically under suspicion as a clever device to further enslavement, unquote. So the other excerpts from Black Theology and Black Power include these. Bullet. Because white theology has consistently preserved the integrity of the community of oppressors, I conclude that it is not Christian theology at all. Insofar as this country is seeking to make whiteness the dominating power throughout the world, whiteness is the symbol of the Antichrist. Whiteness characterizes the activity of deranged individuals intrigued by their own image of themselves and thus unable to see that they are what is wrong with the world. Black theology seeks to analyze the satanic nature of whiteness and by doing so prepare all non-whites for revolutionary action. All right, here's another one. Liberal whites want to be white and Christian at the same time, but they fail to realize that this approach is a contradiction in terms. Christianity and whiteness are opposites. another one, quote, intrigued by their own expertise in Christian theology, white religionists think they have the moral and intellectual right to determine whether black churches are Christian. They fail to realize that their analysis of Christianity is inseparable from their oppressor mentality, which shapes everything they say about God. Last one is, there will be no peace in America until whites begin to hate their whiteness, asking from the depths of their being, how can we become black? So, critical race theory certainly teaches that America is racist at its core, at its founding, at its inception. It's racist because of the original sin of slavery, and they there's nothing that can be done. And I want to also put that in my Think for Yourself series when I get a chance. And that is, if you're accused of something that you had nothing to do with, and there's nothing you can do to make it right or fix it, what's the response to that? What's the answer to that? There's no, you know, it's like heads I win, tails you lose, shut up and eat it. So that makes it, because you're white, you're the devil. That's where it all comes from. So black liberation theology is like I said, what I was studying back in, you know, 2009-ish, 2008-9, put it in my book, Stay Mad, to just kind of explore. Well, then I kind of forgot about it for, like I said, you know, 4 or 5, maybe even 6 years, and started learning about what's going on with the CRT stuff. And there's no fixing. There's no way out without tearing down the society as it stands right now. I don't know if they would be happy with making white people their slaves. Maybe that would fix it, but I don't think even that would fix it. They would take that. They would do that. You know, it seems like they would be willing to return the favor, as it were. But even if they did that for, you know, 200 years, they'd be like, yeah, but you guys still owe us because you did it first, or, you know, whatever. But it's based on, it's a theory, critical race theory. It's a theory. And it's based on the premise of oppressor and the oppressed. And it's like, that is as distilled as you can make critical race theory. That's as far down as I can go. Is there is the way what they believe is there is only two categories, oppressors and the oppressed. With that, how is there ever going to be, with that theory, how is there ever going to be any coming together of different ways of thinking? No, there obviously there isn't going to be, and that's what they need. They need the division. They need the divisiveness. And they, you know, how many times, how many ways I wrote about it in one of the other another chapter or something. You know, all the different ways I could think of that we're divided. Oh, hey, bringing it, boy. Just saw you there. Hey, how's it going? The different ways that they divide people, and then they pit those, you know, those categories against each other. And, you know, if you're not savvy enough to notice that you've been stuffed into a category, and now you start thinking about that other category, you know, like, no, those guys really do smell bad, or those guys really do look ugly. Those guys really, their eyes are just too close together, you know, or whatever it is. I'm just making stuff up, but as you know, little distinctions. And they don't care what the division is. They just need people divided, because if we ever united... It's a good thing there wasn't, you know, elections on September 12th, 2001. That would have gone a long way, but unfortunately they had time to divide us because it didn't take long. It was within, you know, a couple of weeks. All the regular old division was happening again. So, I mean, the oppressor and the oppressed. And that is exactly what was written in the Black Liberation Theology. I was listening to some Levin today, who was reading from his book, American Marxist, which I have, but it's taking me longer to get through the book. I'm still on page 40 something, but because I'm really trying to digest it. And I haven't gotten to the parts that I bought it for, which was to kind of validate what I had written about and researched, you know, regarding the Frankfurt School and the origins of critical theory. Like I said, I stumbled on this concept of critical theory, and that's where all this started. And then they started injecting it to, or applying it to, race, and it just kind of made a whole new, you know, a whole new facet was shaved off the diamond that they're crystallizing to their belief system. Once they injected the race thing, well, then, you know, now they have a weapon that, you know, it's like the hypersonic missile. You can't really defend against it, you know. So somebody calls you a racist. Oh, well, yeah, I guess. I mean, you can say, no, I'm not, but it's not going to say, they're not going to say, oh, you're not? Oh, all right. If you get accused of being racist because of something you did or said, and you say, I'm not racist. I am not in any way racist. They're not going to say, oh, sorry. You know, that's not going to happen. So that's kind of how that ties in. And there's plenty more to get into with that. But all in good time. And it's deep, is what it is. I mean, there's so much stuff. It's like, well, all right, where do I start, you know? Where should we take this? Where do we start with this? What do we get into? I mean, I can go to the Midwest Academy. Well, that's where you go if you're a radical. That's where you learn to be more of a provocateur. That's where you go if you want to be the guy with the megaphone on out in a protest. You would be learning how to direct the masses or a crowd of dupes, basically. Midwest Academy, that's where they teach provocateurism. And they get away with it. And they offer college credits. And they get... That's the next thing that we need to try and expose, is the Midwest Academy. I haven't looked it up recently, but, you know, their reading list starts at number one with a bullet, Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals. And then, like, number two or three on the list is another book by Saul Alinsky. You got Noam Chomsky, you know, and then there's the Howard Zinn, the real history, or the people's history of the United States, or something like that. A quick little story. I think I may have mentioned this before. I was at a management class. The school I was working for, they sent me to this management class. It was like a week long thing. You know, they sent you to school. You know, you had to go through the lessons. And there was a segment in the class during the week that was on ethics. And at the time, I was really big into U.S. history and, you know, the starting of the nation and, you know, reading a lot about the people, you know, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, reading, you know, about things that they wrote, things that they did, things that they said, you know, stuff like that. So the instructor asked a question. He said to the class, and he said, "Like who do you think? I would like a name of somebody who, you know, somebody wants to produce a name. Who do you think is somebody that you would consider very ethical? Who's the most ethical person you either know or have heard of?" You know, so, you know, it was like, well, do they have to be alive? You know, no, they don't, just anybody. So I put my hand, I was like, I think maybe George Washington, because he had a lot of good, you know, decisions to make. So as soon as I said that, this one girl, you know, at the next table was like, George Washington, she slams her hands down. George Washington, are you kidding me? George Washington, the first president of the United States. Yeah. I'm like, yeah. Are you kidding? He was the one that I was having sex with his slaves. You know, and at the time, I really didn't know how to respond to that. And I was like, well, no, I guess I didn't really know that. And, you know, she's going on and on about how, you know, how terrible he was because he had slaves. And then, but not only that, he had sex with his slaves and had children. They had children from him and stuff like that, apparently, according to her. And, you know, this is one of those things I wish I knew then what I knew now, what I know now, because I have since learned that the only reference in any place of the historical writings of the time was a big foot. That was Thomas Jefferson. No, the only reference to any of that at the time was a political smear by a political opponent, where, you know, you put something out there to try to make the person look bad, and, you know, people get exposed to that, and then maybe they won't vote for him, they'll vote for you, you know, that type of thing. But that's all it was. It was a campaign smear by a political opponent. Doesn't make it true. It doesn't really make it the way, you know, the way it was. So there's no, you know, now we would say, okay, so where's the DNA evidence? You know, we would ask for more evidence. There hasn't been anybody come forward that I know of. There hasn't been anybody that you know, claims to be a black descendant of George Washington. I don't know. Who really knows? But if your only information about something like that is that this was a campaign smear by a political opponent, look at the Russian collusion thing. They stole the election. I mean, that was, it's a little bit bigger of a conspiracy and a little more complex. But it doesn't make it true. After all the DNA evidence has been looked at, that wasn't true. So I wished I could have, I wish I'd known that at the time. The other thing was when they crap on, like you say, Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, they were slave owners. Do you know why they were slave owners? Anybody? Bueller? Okay. They were slave owners because they inherited slaves from their parents. The Virginia state legislature had a law for the state or for the Commonwealth that prevented people from freeing slaves. It was against the law to free your slaves. It was also, they had to stay in the line. You could not, you had to pass them down. They were, you had to pass them down to your children. I mean, everything was inherited. So they had it, the Virginia state law had that all locked in. And as I understand it, there were some letters written by both Thomas Jefferson and George Washington lobbying the Virginia legislature to change that law so that they could free the slaves, making them the first abolitionists. So what I'm going to do is talk about the what I wrote about the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. I'm going to just segue right into that. The Declaration and the Constitution are kind of like sister documents, and separate, each of the documents are magnificent, and each one is written beautifully and deliberately, and each word chosen with the utmost care and thoughtfulness. The writers of these documents were not peasants. They were learned scholars and very well read of the works of the time. And learned scholars have a tendency for discipline to organize their life so as to accumulate some means or wealth, if you please. And this is a trait held against the framers of this nation here in our present times. Ask yourself this. Would you rather have had the country framed by poor, uneducated people? Just because the framers of this nation here were white doesn't mean it's a bad thing. Doesn't mean they were rich because they were rich white people. That was a quote from Reverend Wright. Barack knows what it means to be a black man living in a country and a culture that is controlled by rich white people. But it doesn't mean it's a bad thing. So they were rich, so they were white. They still set up this nation based around natural law. When you take these two documents together, the Declaration and the Constitution complement each other and reinforce each other. It has taken well over 200 years to undermine and degrade the intent to its current meaning. 200 years of the creeping incrementalism of progressivism. The principles laid out in the Declaration echo throughout the entire Constitution. Reverberations can be found in the Federalist Papers and also in the Anti-Federalist Papers. Federalist 57 contains principles of competition and ambition. And, quote, if it be asked what is to restrain the House of Representatives from making legal discriminations in favor of themselves and a particular class of the society, I answer, the genius of the whole system, the nature of just and constitutional laws, and above all, the vigilant and manly spirit which actuates the people of America, a spirit which nourishes freedom and in return is nourished by it. If this spirit shall ever be so far debased as to tolerate a law not obligatory on the legislature as well as on the people, The people will be prepared to tolerate anything. Such will be the relation between the House of Representatives and their constituents. Duty, gratitude, interest, ambition itself are the cords by which they will be bound to fidelity and sympathy with the great mass of the people. That's in Federalist 57. And the example I give at the time, if you remember, back in 2010-ish, was the Obamacare. And you know, Joe Biden, when they were signing that, Joe Biden said to Obama, "This is a big effing deal." But it's a law that winds up, down, and around a labyrinth of 2,700 catacomb-like pages. And Congress, our Congress, has carved out the exemption for themselves in favor of a special health care insurance system they set up for themselves, which is good for life. Federalist 51 talks more about the limiting principle. Here we go. Quote, "But the great security against a gradual concentration of the several powers in the same department consists in giving those who administer each department the necessary constitutional means and personal motives to resist encroachments of the others. The provision for defense must, in this, as in all other cases, be made commensurate to the danger of attack." Here's the money quote. "Ambition must be made to counteract ambition. The interest of the man must be connected with the constitutional rights of the place. It may be a reflection on human nature that such devices should be necessary to control the abuses of government." Aside right there is where I would have if I realized it at the time. What they're saying is everybody in their own department has enough power to protect their own department from attacks from the others. The problem today is that people have surrendered their power to a like ideology. And we'll call it, for lack of anything else, progressivism or Marxism. They have surrendered their defense of their own station to Marxism, so that when they see somebody encroaching into an area that should be, you know, that they should be working on, that they should have the rights to. If it's in line with Marxist principles, they'll just turn a blind eye, so to speak. But in the Federalist 51, this next is the following. It says, "It may be a reflection on human nature that such devices should be necessary to control the abuses of government." And here's why I put this in there, this next piece right here. "But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. A dependence on the people is, no doubt, the primary control on the government, but experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions." So, That one is pretty good, you know, on paper. But like I said, when all the people involved have surrendered to an ideology, Marxism, when there's a Marxist encroachment into their department, they turn a blind eye. So anyways, let's see. I got another piece from the Anti-Federalist paper. Let's read this. Letters from the Federal Farmer to the Republican, number one. Speaks about equal treatment of citizens with regard to stations in life. Here we go. Many commercial and moneyed men who are uneasy, not without just cause, ought to be respected and by no means unreasonably disappointed in their expectations and hopes. But as to those who expect employments under the new Constitution, as to those weak and ardent men who always expect to be gainers by revolutions and whose lot it generally is to get out of one difficulty into another, they are very little to be regarded. And as to those who designedly avail themselves of this weakness and ardor, they are to be despised. It is natural for men who wish to hasten the adoption of a measure to tell us, now is the crisis. Now is the critical moment which must be seized or all will be lost. And to shut the door against free inquiry. Whenever conscious, the thing presented has defects in it, which time and investigation will probably discover. This has been the custom of tyrants and their dependents in all ages. It is true, what has been so often said, that the people of this country cannot change their condition for the worse. I presume it still behooves them to endeavor deliberately to change it for the better. The fickle and ardent in any community are the proper tools for establishing despotic government. But it is deliberate and thinking men who must establish and secure government on free principles. See, I'm fair and balanced. I read from the Federalist paper and the Anti-Federalist papers. Is that good enough? All right, got a couple minutes before the top of the hour. I am going to bring in my buddy. I'm pretty sure this is my buddy, Dana.
What's up, my brother? How are you?
Hi, thanks so much for calling in.
I'm just listening to you reading the Anti-Federalist papers and thinking into my neophyte days into politics when I ignored the Anti-Federalist papers. And now I realize I probably would have been writing some of those Anti-Federalist papers in this day and age. They had some striking takes on centralized government.
Patrick Henry was an Anti-Federalist.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's gotten to a point, and, you know, listening to what you're reading there, listen, we all can agree what we're seeing today, just in the last 6 months, has been a push unlike I don't think I've ever seen in my adult life, to this sort of neo-Marxist movement that we're seeing. It's gotten to a point when we're going to have to take each of us a stand, if you will. Some parents are doing it now in these school boards. But we're all in our individual lives going to have to make decisions. And I'm going to use a word that makes some people uncomfortable, Dave, and that is, what is the moral thing to do, right?
Yeah.
And that makes people uncomfortable, but it's very important.
Yeah. And then as I was reading this from the Anti-Federalists, you know, it's basically – I'm going to read this section again, and then I'm going to say a phrase that you all know. It is natural for men who wish to hasten the adoption of a measure to tell us now is the crisis. Now is the critical moment which must be seized or all will be lost. And then they shut the door against free inquiry. So what about this? Never let a crisis go to waste.
Exactly. Whether it be the climate crisis. Right. I mean, it's the same thing. It's, you know, we hear this all the time. The world's going to end. I mean, she changes that AOC from time to time, but the world's coming to an end. We have to act now. And it kind of echoes the language that Joe Biden used in terms of vaccine mandates, right? We're all getting a little tired of this now, right? That's what they're actually saying. Okay, we're not talking about this anymore. Debate's over. You're going to do it our way, and that's it. Because they realize they've gotten close to their goals, Dave. And if they lose this time, it's going to take quite some time for them to kind of build the support they would need to get this close again, if you understand what I'm saying. So this is their moment. They're going for it, like the Battle of the Bulge, yeah. My friend.
Absolutely. And I think I mentioned like probably 4 or 5, maybe 6 years ago, back when I was writing this stuff, you know, I was kind of steeped in, you know, the talk radio, because that's the only place you can get these things.
Right.
And I remember Glenn Beck talking about what was a book called, Insurrection or something like that, you know, it was in France.
I know. Yeah.
And what he was saying is there's going to come a time where they're just going to kind of look side to side at each other. And then they're just going to say, go, 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 go. And then everything is going to be full friggin' speed ahead, because they've finally put enough beans on our side of the on our side of the cup, on our side of the balance to tip the cup, and now they're just going to try and, you know, push everything through. The problem is, as I see it for them, talk radio and all the alternative media.
Well, that's why tech is out there trying to censor everyone. My goodness, Facebook got busted for, you know, trying to suppress, you know, Breitbart, you know, hits on their website.
Yeah.
We know about the fairness doctrine for years. They've talked about that. You know, they want to basically eliminate that, because that's, as you said, that's where I started really getting an education from one Mark R. Levin Esquire, you know, who's like a professor who got me so interested in reading things. And that's what led me to, I think, have a better understanding of what's going on right now, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, they'd love to shut that down, you know? And by the way, we're better at this stuff than they are. I don't know if you guys ever watch any of their programming. They suck, okay? We're much better at what we do.
Yeah.
So.
We could have shows on those TV shows that they have, but,
Listen, as I was once told, I have a face for radio, okay? So that's why you stay behind. People don't want to see this. It's not a pretty sight. Yeah.
So listen, I know I just barely brought you in, but that's just kind of to hopefully set up. I've got a couple of things that I want to – when I come back, all right, when we come back on the other end of the top of the hour break there, I want to talk a couple of things, all right? And I just want to get in there. I noticed Joe Biden, when he does his creepy whisper thing, or when he does his angry yelling thing, he says like the same word or phrase 3 times in a row. You ever noticed that?
I have, actually. Yeah. My grandfather used to do that, and then we put him in the home. So that's what works.
The only thing I can think of is Will Ferrell's character in Austin Powers, Mustafa, who will break whenever the question is repeated 3 times.
Well, the other day he was kind of like Ricky Bobby with those hands at that town hall.
Oh,
I know. I'm not sure
that
what to do with
hilarious.
My hands.
That was hilarious. I saw a meme where they turned him into, they put him side by side with Beavis and Butthead with the, you know, and then they had him holding 2 hot dogs or holding 2 flags or, you know, it was that, those were hilarious. I was like, what is he really, is it going to look like he's saying, okay, I got this. All right, shut up. We need to talk before I forget what I'm going to say.
Oh, so, it's a shame. I mean, it's funny, but it's not. Right.
All right. So I got like three or four more things here. When we come back, Alec Baldwin, that whole thing. There's like a couple of developing narratives that I've stumbled across, and you know, it's they're not, they're like disconnected, each of them, you know, I don't know if it's people just running their mouths. So we'll talk about that.
Okay.
Probably the horrific puppy experiments with the sand fleas.
Oh, my God, yeah.
That,
yeah.
I mean, that's hard to even talk about. And then the Attorney General.
Oh, my Lord. You are really going down the rabbit hole tonight. That guy, yeah. Okay, we'll save it. That's called a tease.
I want to play all those clips. I want to play all those clips, but I'm not going to. We're just going to talk about it. Everybody's heard them. So, but now, today, there is some new information on the 2020 election violations in Wisconsin. Let's see. All right. So, and I already did my Black Liberation Theology thing. All right. So, so that's what we'll do. Hang in there. We'll be back in a few minutes. All right. We'll listen to G Ski Rocks's How Smart Is Your President? That's pretty funny. All right. Here we go.
You're listening to Renaissance Radio on Airwaves America with Dave and G.C. Rock.
Hello, and welcome to How Smart Is Your President? A game show testing the intelligence of President Barack Obama. And now, here's your host, G.C. Rock!
Thank you! Thank you! You are too kind. Thank you. Hello, everybody, and welcome to How Smart Is Your President? A game show testing the intelligence of President Barack Obama. And, of course, here's our guest. Here's our player. Let's everybody welcome President Barack Hussein Obama. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show. We want to thank you for hanging out with us. Welcome to How Smart Is Your President? Testing the intelligence of President Barack Obama. Our player for today, of course, the President of the United States, Barack Hussein Obama. Now, we went over the rules backstage. The game is very simple. We're going to ask you a series of questions, and you hit the fancy-smancy buzzer to answer the question. And we're going to start off right now. Question number one, how many states make up the United States of America?
I've now been in 57 states. I think one left to go.
Sorry, Mr. President. The answer to the question is 50. 50 states make up the United States of America. Next question, name one European country.
Compared to countries like Europe?
Sorry, Mr. President. Europe is not a country. Sorry. next question. What is one of the treatments for asthma?
A breathalyzer. Or an inhalator. Not a breathalyzer.
Sorry, Mr. President. You meant to say inhaler. Inhaler was the answer that you are looking for. All right. Next question. Okay. As the President of the United States of America, recite for me the First Amendment of the United States Constitution.
Hold on a second. Wait. Hold on.
Sorry, Mr. President, time's up. The First Amendment of the United States Constitution states as follows. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances, something that you clearly know nothing about. Anyway, moving on, last and final question, Mr. President. Name the Mexican holiday in the month of May.
The Cinco de Cuatro.
Sorry, Mr. President, that was the wrong answer. You said 4 of 5. The answer to the question is Cinco de Mayo, the 5th of May. That is the correct answer, and you are wrong again. Well, that's all the time that we have, folks. I want to thank you for listening. Thank you for tuning in. Catch us next time when we play How Smart Is Your President? Testing the intelligence of President Barack Obama. I'm your host, G-Ski Rocks, and I'm out of here. Peace out, y'all.
You have entered the reality zone. This is a collection of internet talk radio hosts who, like you, have finally gotten sick of the mainstream media. Please join the ever-growing family of listeners and callers who are at the beginning of the next big thing. Internet radio is a true marketplace because there are so many regular people hosting. Be sure to weed through them and then come back to our group, as so many listeners have already done. This is real people, real conversations, and real opinions. Side effects may include anger, increased awareness, deeper understanding of American exceptionalism, a severe loss of political correctness, increased motivation to participate in politics, support for rugged individualism, a true blue love for country, vomiting if you're still a liberal, increased ability to recognize Alinsky's rules for radicals, a clearer understanding of capitalism, the ability to win more arguments. You will become a self-appointed roadblock to the creep of cultural Marxism and Sharia inside this country. Do not drive or operate heavy machinery until you know how the show will affect you.
And we're back. Thanks very much. This is the Dave and G-Ski Rocks show. And with me on the line is Dana Smearman. Thanks for joining us, Dana, and
certainly
kicking it around with us tonight. G-Ski's not with us. He's listening, though. I love that How Smart Is Your President gag. That was hilarious.
That's a classic. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We had talked about, I mean, it would be like a 3-hour show if we were to do
right
it with this president.
Right. Good Lord, you couldn't. I mean, he's just. That's why it's just amazing to me that, you know, comedy's become politically correct, which is it should never be. But this guy, if you're a comedy writer, I mean, my goodness, is the gift, as you say, that keeps on giving. I mean, it's amazing
Robin
he's so
Williams
well protected by this. Yeah.
Robin Williams called him Ramblin' Joe Biden.
Right. Right. But I just, you know, it's amazing to watch this go on, and it's funny, but it isn't, because our futures are at stake.
Right.
But there's no hiding anymore. If there's anybody that wants to make the argument that man is not in cognitive decline, I got a lot of money that I will write you a big check if you can prove to me in some way that he is with it 100%. Because let's be honest, the man was dumb before he was demented. I mean, let's be honest about this. So
right.
He's got the double whammy going right now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no argument for me. You know, that's like I said – that's why Robin Williams called him Ramblin' Joe Biden, because he says shit that even people with Tourette's say, nah.
Oh, when FDR got on television and addressed the nation, right? You know, stuff like that. Yeah. Been
so
going on for years.
What was the thing? Now, I saw, you know, a quick little TikTok where Joe Biden is shaking the hand of the Pope, and he starts talking about an African-American baseball player. But that's where the TikTok ends. So I don't have the context.
I do not know. I did not see it, so I couldn't comment on it. But all I can tell you is, listen, you know, I don't know why we bother letting him out anymore. He should treat the presidency much like you treat the campaign. Stay in the White House. Don't go anywhere. You embarrass us everywhere you go. It's amazing to me. Listen, you know, I talked about it. We didn't let my grandfather out of the house after a certain point because he would just, you know, he would wander along and say inappropriate things. At that point, you got to bring him in and consider help, right? I think visiting angels should be able to get into the White House. That's all I'm going to say. Get the man some help. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, you should. They should get some help. Mm-hmm. Hold on, I'm going to see if I can find this here. Hold on. I'm still scrolling. That's the cool thing about TikTok is you know, 3 hours can go by and you don't even realize it. So I have to go way back.
Go down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. But some of them, you know, all right, hold on. It's loading. Here is the, what are you doing? Get back to there. Get back.
Thank you for that.
He was a famous African-American baseball player in America.
Okay, so the Pope is shaking his hand, and he says, thank you for that. The Pope says, thank you for that. And that's what Biden says. And it sounded like he said, you're the famous African-American baseball player in America.
I don't know who he's referring to. I mean, is he referring to Jackie Robinson? I don't know what he's talking about. Listen, if you're asking me to interpret this man, I can't help you.
I didn't know if you had heard more of it than
I hadn't heard more about it. I didn't even hear that clip, as a matter of fact. It's just amazing.
It just popped
to
up today. That's the first time I saw it was today. All right.
When I got up today, I worked the night before, so when I got up today, the only thing I was seeing on my feed was all about the little fake white supremacist thing at the Yunkin rally in Virginia, where they had a bunch of Democrat operatives with tiki torches. They've been since busted as being Democrat operatives, so I was too interested in that, you know, whole thing going on there to really go beyond it. It just fascinated me that this is what they're doing. And because I think Terry McAuliffe, as we all know, is in trouble in Virginia. Well, should he be as well? But they marched out a bunch of people to have this fake, you know, white supremacy thing going on. So,
yeah,
I got caught down that rabbit hole today, Dave. You know.
Oh, now who's the lawyer that he just hired? The
Mark Elias, who specializes
Mark
in anybody? Yeah. He specializes in election fraud. Now, remember before, if you mention election fraud in regards to the 2020 presidential election, you were called a conspiracy theorist and misinformation. Now, I'm going to ask a question to the audience. They're probably a pretty smart audience if they're listening to this show. Why would you need to hire somebody like that before the election happens?
Thank you.
Right?
Before the election, right.
Right. Like, we're already gearing up for this. It's just like, you know, the whole thing with Stacey Abrams still being the governor of Georgia, as I understand.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know. But if you were bringing up that story about Wisconsin, if we talk about things like that, we're labeled, what, conspiracy theorist white supremacist, too, I believe. Because you just call everybody a white supremacist.
That's all it takes. I covered that in the Black Liberation Theology section at the minute. Okay, so – Let me play. I got two TikToks here, and then each of them is a different Alec Baldwin narrative on why that person got killed, the person that died, the lady that died.
Okay.
Right. Here's the first one. Well, I'll just turn it up. Hold on.
On today's episode of Connecting the Dots with the Democrats, we bring you Alec Baldwin, who we all know. Alec Baldwin, tragically last week, pointed a loaded weapon at this young lady, tragically shooting and killing her. Now, this young lady, her husband, this gentleman right here, he worked for a very well-to-do law firm, Latham & Watkins. Latham & Watkins just happened to represent Michael Sussman, who was the basically ringleader of the entire Russian collusion during the time he worked for this evil wench right here,
Clinton.
The Clinton campaign. And we all know that that gentleman now is being indicted by John Durham. Now, I'm not saying this is connected in any way. All I'm saying is you have to admit, it's a tiny bit suspicious.
All right, so that narrative is saying it has to do with Sussman.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from those dots being connected, it seems like an intimidation on the guy that they're indicting with Sussman. The lawyer representing Sussman, mm-hmm. right? The firm, so as I understand it, the firm that's representing Sussman, the guy that's the lawyer there, his wife was the one that just got accidentally dispatched. Is that
intriguing? It's intriguing, and I will tell you this: if it were reversed, if this had happened to a conservative actor, such that they are, flashed all over. And how long did MSNBC go with the Russian hoax? And,
the whole time.
Right. So yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up. That's
on.
A narrative I hadn't heard, but I would have said. 5 years ago, Dave, I would have said, come on, man, we're going down that tinfoil hat road. Anymore, you could probably convince me that most of these things actually happen the way that they're proposed to have happened. I'm starting to realize that the world works a hell of a lot differently than I believed it did, say, 5 to 10 years ago. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, so in other words, that's what I got out of that,
mm-hmm.
you know, that narrative was, okay, they killed this lawyer's wife who represents Sussman. They're intimidating him to, you know, to represent Sussman a certain way, I guess.
I mean, I don't know all the specifics, but, you know, I think sometimes I feel this way, Dave, and I don't mean to be too conspiratorial on your guys' program. But, you know, once 2020 happened with the COVID and the lockdowns and the election and the, you know, how they changed the rules on everything, and then come out and tell us absolutely nothing was wrong. Everything was above board, the most clean election ever. And I think if the real truth came out, here's my theory about all of this stuff into it, is that if the American public knew what really went on behind the scenes, and their worldview would be changed so much that I don't know that those in charge would be able to control people anymore. Do you understand what I'm saying? They mm-hmm. would say, oh, my God, look at what's happened. We've been manipulated for years. We know this. The media does it. Politicians have done it. And now they actually rig things. Now, we know they do. We know there's cheating. To have an idea that there's no election without fraud is absolutely ridiculous. I give you my home state of West Virginia and a guy named John Kennedy. Okay? That's all I'll say about that. Okay? It's happened before. It certainly will happen again. I think this happened on a much more massive scale. It wouldn't surprise me if that were the case with this poor cinematographer who was shot. By the way, as an aside, for any of us who've actually had a weapon in our hands, whether we think the weapon is loaded or not, for those people out there who have used the weapon, do you ever point it at someone, Dave? Ever?
No, of course not. If I'm an actor in a scene and the scene is calling for that, which is what my understanding is, this was during a take or a rehearsal for a take.
Rehearsal, as I understand it, yeah.
Okay, so... You know, in that situation, you know, somebody told him it was a cold gun. It obviously
right.
wasn't.
Here's my thing with Alec Baldwin. This is not the first time in a movie that man's had a gun in his hand. At some point, being on a set and being around other people who are not a 21-year-old meth head armorer, you would understand that some people actually take safety correct. If somebody hands me a gun and says cold gun day, what am I going
to
do?
You
what am I going
to
do with that weapon?
You have
exactly.
To check.
It's incumbent upon you to do that. All right. And, you know, whether or not this goes down the pathway that we're discussing or whether it's not that this was just a set that was completely out of control because it was a low-budget set and Alec Baldwin's an idiot, I don't know which is true. But I can tell you no matter what.
All of it. All of it so far.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just saying that at some point, what I'd like to hear is Alec Baldwin take some damn responsibility, okay, which he is not to this
right.
point.
Right. But, I mean – in the meantime, I have – as much as I hate to, I actually have a little bit of sympathy for him because he was told something, he believed something, it didn't turn out to be the case. And
there was a guy once, I don't remember his name.
Have ended somebody's life that way.
Right.
And you now have to carry that around with you. So I have a little bit of sympathy.
But he looks like he's grieving. Let me just tell you, you're a much better person than I am. There was a guy once, I can't remember his name, he had this phrase, he would say, trust but verify. Man, he would say that a lot.
Yeah.
You know, if you hand me a weapon, we're talking about a weapon now, and I'm sorry, but I know there are other, listen, there are other movies that have a hell of a lot more gunplay. If this were the case where we didn't know what to do with weapons, then everybody on the set of John Wick should be dead right now. You understand what I'm saying? It just doesn't make sense to me. And I don't listen, sympathy to a certain extent, but following the shooting and watching his actions, he doesn't look like he has a lot of remorse. Okay? And
well,
that's
here's
what
the
I'm
other
saying.
Narrative.
He came out right.
Yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was going to introduce the other narrative and just see what you think about this one. Because this is different. It's just a guy. It's a real short one. Okay, but it's just a guy that's he might just be running his mouth, but here we go.
So the woman accidentally shot by Alec Baldwin. We get it. It was an accident. We know. Shh, leave us alone. We know. She was also working on a powerful documentary exposing child pedophilia in Hollywood.
That's the other narrative.
You know what? Now you're really starting to get me. Why are you doing this to me tonight for? Now I got to go home tonight and I got to put the tinfoil hat on because that's amazing. If that's true, good Lord.
Both can be true, but not both probably together.
Absolutely.
But not both at the same time. Let me rephrase.
You know what?
Each could be true.
Mm-hmm.
Each could be true, but I don't think both can be true at the same time.
I don't know
they
that
they just go
right.
in so much, so many different directions. You know that they're like.
Do you understand that? To go back to what I was saying before, if we could pull the veil off of what actually goes on with people who are the elites, we like to refer to them as. I don't know that our brains could handle what some of these people do when we don't see them, when they're behind the closed door, if you will.
Right. Yeah.
And
I
we
agree.
Know.
Yeah.
We know that this pedophilia problem, now maybe it's amplified now because it's much easier for pedophilia to occur with the internet and social media and stuff. But my goodness, it seems like there's been an explosion, right? Yeah. it's satanic. Can I use that word on your show?
Yeah.
You guys believe in Satan
yep.
and evil? Satanic
sure.
is what this is. And I think until people start to realize that we're really dealing in a battle of good versus evil. Marxism is evil. It's satanic. Okay.
Absolutely.
The very tenets of it are satanic. And unless we start to admit that to ourselves and understand that we might be in the greatest battle of our entire lives and get serious about it, I don't know that anything's going to change. It encourages me to see parents being involved. But I have a message for parents. Where you been for 10, 15 years? People have been talking about this stuff for a decade, Dave.
Who knew the books that are in the library were in the library?
Oh.
Who knew that? I mean, somebody knew, yes. But
yes,
the parents didn't.
Yes. And I'm glad to see the parents are rising up. And I think this is the thing in Virginia that's very interesting is I think the whole idea with McCullough's campaign is when he comes out and tells parents they really don't have a right to have a say in what their children learn.
Yeah. What I found awesome, was when a parent got up there and started reading from the book, and they made her stop saying, "Hey, there's kids in here."
There's kids in here.
And she goes, "I get it."
Well, somebody who is as educated as you are on Marxism and understands what, you immediately have to get the children away from their parents. Remember in the Soviet Union, right?
Oh, yeah.
You would have the red weddings, the red births, and once the child was born, the mother would do what? Give it over to the collective, right? To be educated, to be nurtured, to be a good member of the state. So you can see these things happening, and whether people want to admit that to themselves or not, now that's your problem. It's happening out there. We're seeing it, okay? And we have to stand up and fight this. And it's a moral fight. A decade ago or more now, I had a little blog talk radio show that was entitled, "What is so important that you would fight and die for?" This was over the Obamacare issue.
Yeah.
And I think now, if I were to go back and revisit that show, it's probably a little more prescient, because what is it that's so important to you as an individual that you would say, nope, here's the line in the sand? Like Martin Luther, I stand here because I can do no other. And we're going to have at this. For me, it's vaccination mandates. That's where I draw the line. You will not force me or my wife or my family to do something that we do not wish to do. There's an idea in medicine called informed consent, right, Dave? We take information. We say, okay, I've got this now. I don't feel comfortable. I'm not going to do it. Or I am going to do it. Okay?
Well, that's the same line that, matter of fact, Dan Bongino took. Because Cumulus Media they started a mandate, and he came right out. He went head first after him. He's not on the radio anymore. In other words, they called his bluff so far.
I had immense respect for Dan Bongino, and when he did that, it went up like 100-fold. Okay,
Now I listen to his podcast. You know, I used to just listen to the radio of him, but now he's not on the radio, or the reruns. You know, the first day the reruns are on, I was like,
so let me ask a question out there. When are these people going to realize that you may be able to intimidate certain people? I don't know that anything in the world intimidates that man.
No.
It just doesn't.
No. I mean, he's laid his groundwork, and he's got, you know, he's got some, you know, good solid income / investments or whatever. And, you know, he's the one that is creating the parallel economy with, you know, Rumble for YouTube.
Right.
And,
but Dave, still, even at that, he walked away from a syndicated radio show.
I know.
Okay.
I mean,
that is huge.
That was huge.
Yeah.
Huge.
And I think that's what's going to happen. Sometimes what we ask ourselves, and I don't mean to get too philosophical because it drags the show down, and I know G-Ski is going, come on, keep it light. But here's what I want to say.
No, he's not. He likes the drama. Don't worry.
There's going to be certain times in which you're going to be in a moral dilemma, Dave, right? And it may come down to losing your job and all that entails. But the moral imperative is you must do what is right. Okay, because in the end, and this is what I truly believe our problem is in this nation today, and this is not somebody who's coming off as a fundamentalist Christian, folks, but when you cease to believe that there is only one power in the universe that you will bend a knee to, you got a problem, okay? There's one moral authority in the universe. It isn't Joe Biden. It's not the Democrat Party, okay? And we as individuals know this. Do the moral thing, and it may hurt. It may hurt you to do that, but in the long run, it's going to be better for you, better for your family, and I dare say better for the nation. And that's, I'm going to get off my soapbox before G-Ski goes, cut him, cut his mic.
He'll be texting me. What's he doing? No, but all right. So let's put a pin in that then.
Okay.
I don't really even want to talk about these puppy experiments. I just wanted to acknowledge them. That's all I want to do. I don't even want to talk about it.
Yes, please do.
So I'm going to skip
don't
over that.
My wife has avoided the actual details of this because we are dog lovers. We have our own dog here. If my wife details, I don't think she would sleep at night. So we've kept all the details. And I think for your audience, if you don't know, we're not going to talk details.
Yeah.
But this man, you know what I first thought, Dave? I first thought, paging Dr. Mengele? Is Dr. Mengele in the building?
Yeah.
That's what I first thought.
Even if it's not him, he's funding what those other people are doing.
He's funding it.
They're just,
yeah.
You want to talk about good and evil and being a devil?
Oh.
I mean, that's just as bad as it gets. All right. So, Attorney General. The Attorney General let's start this by saying, boy, did we dodge a bullet. And that's the one thing so far, you know, in this radio show that we can give Mitch McConnell a nod on. That's the, you know, but nothing more.
No. But that's a good,
but this
one,
here,
I mean,
where he stood in the way of Obama's nomination for the Supreme Court with, what, a couple of months left of his term.
He wanted
Merrick Garland. He nominated him for the Supreme Court.
Yes.
You know, and I worked with people at the time. That was back when I was working still at the high school. And there were people that were, you know, that were caught up in narrative and stuff like that. And they were like, well, still, you know, what's wrong with Merrick Garland? I mean, he's, you know, he's kind of milquetoast neutral.
Right?
Yeah, moderate. Yeah. Right. Not anymore. And I got a feeling,
you know,
that they knew that when they nominated him.
Well, of course they did. I mean, here's the thing. When I was watching the hearings and some of the hearings when they were talking to him there, you know who he reminds me of? Back in the day when Saturday Night Live was funny, you remember Martin Short used to play the nervous little lawyer that would smoke a lot, and it was their 60 Minutes thing, and he'd say, "No, what do you mean? I know that. Why would you think I wouldn't know that?" Right? He'd be real nervous all the time. That's what it reminded me of, is he's getting these questions. Like, he wasn't prepared for what they were going to do and what they were going to ask. And it's obvious to me that when you are telling parents that they're concerned about their children, we're going to put an X on you and say you're a domestic terrorist, or we're going to bring the National Security Division into the equation, that you now have become a political apparatchik of the White House. How very Soviet of you, right, to put your enemies on a list and go after them.
Okay. Let's acknowledge that and say maybe. Yes. Let's say that he is all of that. What I'm about to say will make you realize that he doesn't need to be that to be in the category that we're putting him. Because it is his son-in-law that creates materials for critical race theory and sells that material to school districts and makes millions.
Right.
And when asked about whether he sought an ethics review, he said, well, you know, if I thought there was a conflict of interest, I certainly would have sought an ethical rule. That's not how it works, General.
No, and to go touch back on the previous subject, when your wife is the head of bioethics at NIH, I guess you can do whatever the hell you want to do. You see how incestuous this all is?
Fauci's wife?
Yes. Head of bioethics, which means that when you're doing the horrible things to animals that you're doing, if you really understood bioethics, you'd be saying, hey, dummy, stop it, right? Okay. Stop using 5-year-olds as a trial group for your vaccine. Stop doing that. That's horrible, right? But she's not saying that because it's incestuous and they're all evil. And I said it on your radio show, and I don't care who hears it. They're evil. And people need to understand when we talk about the word evil is that it requires us to look at things differently, right? This is not just a mere political difference, okay? This is what evil looks like. And you have to fight that with every fiber of your being, Dave. You have to, or they're going to win. And that's a very scary thought.
Yep. And so like I said, not only is he the apparatchik, of the White House, he has his own. He has his own hidden agenda, undulating, you know, and that he can't see. I mean, is that the first time he realized? You know, when Ted Cruz was asking him about it, or one of the other ones, Cotton,
right?
You know, about ethics violations. you know, and if I thought that there was a conflict of interest, you know, oh, Nadler, your time has expired. Your time has expired.
Your time's expired. When he woke up from his narcoleptic nap, listen.
I found another. I'm sorry. But before I forget, I found a Jerry Nadler. he's like the chair of a committee. He's talking with somebody about the Second Amendment. Am I turned up here? Okay, all right. And this is just a quick exchange. You know, the guy talks about the Second Amendment. But in Nadler's question, the first voice you're going to hear is Jerry Nadler, and he's stuttering all over the place before he gets his question. And he's talking about this guy. I'm going to comment on what he just said. All right. So here's the thing.
You said that you could use a semiotic weapon to fight tyranny.
Sure.
You mean you'd use it against American troops?
Okay. So at that point.
Oh my God.
At that point, I'm pausing it because at that point I would say, you would use American troops on me? Right? Right? I mean, right?
Exactly,
I mean,
yeah.
Doesn't that smash you in the face with a baseball bat?
Smash you right in the face with that. And
yeah, the rest of
I
it.
Love the fact. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Dana. I'll play this in a minute.
I'm just going to tell you this. I am sick and tired of being lorded over by people who have less than a room temperature IQ. Can we stop already?
I know.
Okay, can we stop it already?
I don't even know who he was talking to. I don't know who this guy is.
To fight tyranny. Those damn semi-automatic weapons.
So here it is.
You said that you could use a semi-automatic weapon to fight tyranny.
Sure.
You mean you'd use it against American troops?
The very existence of the Second Amendment is designed purposefully to empower the people to be able to resist the force of tyranny used against them to step over their natural rights given to them by God. That is why the Second Amendment exists. That is very specifically why the Second Amendment exists.
That's a pretty good answer.
However, I think it's a damn good answer.
Yeah. No, because it's perfect. But my question remains to you saying you would use them on American troops. You'd use American troops on me?
Mm-hmm. That's what you would do. Of course they would.
Okay. Tit for tat. You use your troops on me. I use my semi-automatic weapon.
Semi-automatic weapon,
yes.
Which they're so afraid of.
Yes.
I don't. Here's a rule I have.
That is like a hanging chad. That's like a grapefruit over the home plate. You know.
I refuse to discuss gun issues with any of these people who've never actually fired a weapon. That's a rule I have. I'm not going to even talk to you unless you've actually put a weapon in your hand at least once and fired a weapon. Understand the terminology that you're dealing with.
Because you know,
okay?
as soon as they fire a weapon, they're going to say, this is pretty
damn
awesome.
That's awesome. Yeah. This whole concept of having discussions with people, the gun rights, or, you know,
yeah,
is the fact that I'm tired of having a discussion of an assault rifle. What the hell does that even mean?
Yeah,
okay.
If
I pick up a rock and hit you in the head, is it an assault rock? I mean, come
yes,
on.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Okay.
Especially if it's chiseled into the shape of some leaning things, you know, some tilting handles.
Yeah. Jerry Nadler, my favorite clip of Jerry Nadler, I don't know if you guys have ever seen this one, is the one where he's standing up there and it almost looks like he crapped himself, right? And he has to like scoot off the stage because I'm pretty sure he crapped his pants.
Yeah,
and yeah,
yes, Jerry Nadler looking quickly side to side and then backing
Oopsie.
Up and then yeah,
I got the turtle poking out. There you go, Jerry. Way to go, buddy.
Turtle head poking out.
Turtle head. Because that's what I think about him. I think of Austin Powers, Fat Bastard, when I think of Jerry Nadler. That's what I think of, you know.
Yeah, well, I believe that he is a turtle. the turtle head.
Oh. Oh, yeah. I eat a baby. Right? You know, that kind of thing.
I eat a baby.
Yeah, eat a baby.
Get
yeah,
in
I
my
mean,
belly.
Get in my belly. And this is the people who have, they have positions of a power and authority. I mean, America, come on, man. As Joe would say, we can do better than this.
Come on,
okay,
man.
We can. And I got to say something else before we move on with these Republicans in the hearing. Okay, Tom Cotton, Ted Cruz, all of you, I love you guys. You're firebrands. I get it. But I have to say this. Words don't mean much to me. Okay? That's great that you guys held them to. What else are you going to do? Right? Are you really going to hold these people's feet to the flame? Or are we just going to have speeches that we fundraise off of? You know?
Okay.
You understand?
Fair
I'm
enough.
A little tired of that.
Fair okay? enough. Fair enough, Dana. Yes, fair yep. enough. Let me ask you, what else can they do?
Well, at this point, I believe that they have, especially with this idea of his son-in-law, they have every right. He said, well, you know, ethics, you know, you could refer that to the justice. Hey, listen, we want you to look into this. Have they done that? I don't know if they have. They may have. I don't know if they have. And the idea that they're following the senator from Arizona into bathrooms, he said that hasn't been referred to him. Well, refer it to him. Okay, and say, look into this. You know, I want them to use they can.
I understood that one was referred and that was being investigated, and that he can't.
I hope so, because and not because I'm a big fan of Kristen Sinema, because let me tell you something.
I get it. But
of West Virginia, Joe Manchin,
there's
snakes in the grass. But you know, you don't deserve to follow someone into a bathroom and harass.
Right, the whole goose and gander thing. You wouldn't tolerate it on your side, type of thing. I get
exactly.
it. And that is intellectually honest. And you know, obviously we appreciate that, and it makes sense. I don't know what else they can do other than expose them.
I guess maybe I'm just frustrated because even when they had the majority, they didn't do anything. Okay.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
They
yeah,
didn't really
yeah,
take
there
the
is
steps
that.
Necessary.
There is. That.
And many of them fought the former president on
but,
some
okay.
of his agenda. So, I'm a little tired of that. I
right.
guess is
and,
what
and
it is.
I agree. Now, you're gonna agree with me on this. I'm pretty sure because mm-hmm. when they had a majority, who was in charge of that majority?
Right.
The turtle.
Right.
So
in your
that,
audience,
that,
if you close your eyes, you probably thought Mitch McConnell was on the program. That's how good I am, people.
Yeah,
that,
yeah that's
am.
Pretty good. Yeah, that was
yeah.
great. So,
that
but,
was good,
but,
man.
But that was great. So the point is that's where the Republicans are
right.
exposed. Are exposed
yes.
to, you know, criticism
yes.
or critique or whatever is because
but here's my question.
The guy
I don't – maybe you know the answer to this because I don't have it in front of me. When you're talking about Mitch McConnell, I mean, some of our firebrands on our side, did they vote for him as majority leader?
No.
Because if they did, then I'm going to tell you that's a problem, okay?
Right,
you got to start
right.
saying
some,
to somebody,
some
we
did,
need different leadership.
Right, right. Here's the problem, though. Okay, and it's that Mitch McConnell controls the purse strings of the RNC, and he holds that over everybody that supports and or opposes him.
Now, I'm going to say a couple things, because before people get mad at me, it's not that I'm anti-Republican. I'm not. I think what's happened to me is I've had sort of an awakening to realize that there are many Republicans who, let's be honest with us, they're not that dissimilar from Democrats, right? They're not.
Right.
They all believe in big government, just it's what extent is that government going to be. And I guess
right.
I've gotten to a point where I'm like, listen, we got to have some people in there that are going to start talking about things that you and I are concerned about, you know, talking about the printing of money, right, until it's going to take us a $10,000 to buy a loaf of bread. Okay, we're concerned about things, not just for us, but as I believe a document talked about, our posterity, correct? We have
yep.
a responsibility to guard freedom and pass it along. I want more firebrands like that, maybe have more of an influence, and if that means standing up to Mitch McConnell and his money bags, then by God, do it, okay?
No,
that's all
I
I'm
know.
Saying.
However, the people who are attracted to the job weighs in. It's that's a factor. people who are attracted to the job are attracted to the job because they want to have some kind of a power. They want to feel like they
have
power.
Well, I'm going to say
this is a human nature.
You're right.
Thing, okay,
it is,
so
absolutely.
That when they get called into Mitch McConnell's office when they first get in there, and he tells them the way the world works, quote unquote, you know, and that he can keep them in that job as long as they support him.
You might remember this from many years ago. The fine
all I'm
Eddie
saying
Murphy
is
movie
that's,
called
that's attractive to somebody. Go ahead.
Do you remember the Eddie Murphy movie, The Distinguished Gentleman, where he played the congressman who got elected based on name recognition because another guy?
I don't think.
If you've never
I
seen
don't
the
think
movie,
I've seen that.
I'm telling you, Dave, watch it because it is so pressing because it describes exactly what you're talking about. When he gets there as a freshman congressman, having this man who's been there, the veteran guy, telling him how things actually work, right? And it's at the time, you know, it's very cynical in its outlook, but it's absolutely accurate in the way things apparently work in Washington, right?
How can it? I mean, if you give it a moment's thought and you apply human nature, how can it not be the case?
I'm going to suggest, what is your choice? Well, I don't know. I think one thing I will say, and I continue to believe in, and I see it more and more, are states saying, hey, listen, federal government, we have rights, and we're going to exercise them. Okay? I think the way you hold people accountable is forget about Washington, D.C., and start having politics, as they say, all politics are local, and treat it as that, right? Be concerned about your local races and your school boards and your mayors and your county councilmen and such and let's start there. Maybe that's the way we fight back, because I don't know that you can correct the Washington problem.
Not for nothing, but that's kind of what's happening with the school board meetings, you know, and the NEA or whatever, you know. So that's good. So that has to be where it starts. Because
absolutely.
For so long, as you say, they were just not paid any attention to. And the manifestation of that is, well, the people getting promoted up and getting up. And now, oh, yeah, I heard about that guy. I guess I'll vote for him, you know, type of thing. And up and up and up they go. Well, you know, they're not good people that are getting jobs.
I think what I would say, you talked about it earlier, obviously you talked about black liberation theory, so you're talking about critical theory. It's a Marxist theory. I'm sure you mentioned that. And the concept of what that is doing to our society, and especially teaching young people this poison, it has to stop. And I don't care if you have kids in school or not. You pay taxes, right? You have every right to go to those school boards and make your viewpoint, okay, heard as well, is you're paying for this stuff. And it angers me to a point that you take children and poison their minds the way they are doing. It is disgusting, and it needs to stop. And I'm encouraged by some of these movements. I hope it continues on and people understand how important it is, like for the governor of Virginia, for you to get out and vote for that person. Because, I mean, Glenn Youngkin, he may have faults, but I'll tell you what. Terry McAuliffe is a creature of the swamp. We know.
Connected
to the Clintons and the whole bit.
He's a big swamp guy, absolutely.
And by the way, down in Georgia, since I know D. Ski lives down there, I am very enthusiastic about the senatorial candidate of one Herschel Walker. So
I hope
he wins, because Herschel Walker's a fine man, and we need people like that to represent.
And
I'm not anti-Ted Cruz. You know, I love Ted Cruz. I love all of them. I love Josh Hawley, all of them. I just want you to say, listen, sometimes you're going to have to take it up a notch. And you're going to have to tell Mitch McConnell, no, we're not raising the debt ceiling again temporarily.
That's the thing.
No, we got to stop doing
that's
this.
That's the thing.
Okay?
It's great to see the sound bites for election on YouTube or whatever, or TikTok. But, you know, you got to stand up to Mitch McConnell. That's where you're going to get the support. Because what you need to do is expose Mitch McConnell as the scumbag swamp creature that he is. And
it has been his entire life.
Right.
Reagan's coattails into office, but he was a Ford guy.
He didn't even vote for Reagan.
Guy.
You're right.
No.
You're right about that.
Okay.
So you mentioned Georgia, and there's actually some 2020 election information that's come out, but I don't have it. What I do have.
Sweet.
What do you think of that segue? What I do have.
I love that. That was pretty amazing what you did there.
Is in Wisconsin.
Right.
What they have discovered is that, and this is kind of like the, you know, the sliver on top of the water of the iceberg, the tiny little piece, is residents at nursing homes. By the way, I heard that, and I know what you just did. So residents at nursing homes that were like out of it, that there's no way they could have, you know, cast any ballot, according to their family, you know, on those dates, you know, that person was in hospice, or, you know, or that person was, you know, when that was done, there's no way they could have understood that document to have voted and stuff like that. And those votes were counted. And it actually, you know, it's in the probably tens of thousands that they're now investigating in that vein from just from nursing homes alone. So somebody filled out their ballots, you know, and then all of the ones that you show up on the day to vote and they say, no, you've already voted. You know, well, what is that? That somebody stole my vote then, because that wasn't me, you know? So what I'm curious about, okay, this information is out there. A, the Arizona audit information is out there. B, the Georgia audit information is out there. I need to find out, and I don't know. And I'm going to probably ask the guy that I work with, who's a big lib lefty. What is,
God bless you,
what is the opposing narrative to all this information that's coming out? I'm wondering what they're saying about it.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you too. I have friends who are still involved in the Republican politics in Pennsylvania, and they are pushing for an audit there heavily because they believe there were a lot of irregulars. And one of the things that they mentioned,
there was,
which I think the great one Mark Levin mentioned, is simply the fact that you change election laws without the involvement of the legislature.
Of the legislature.
Which,
exactly. I mean, that's
which
enough.
Should have been validated, all of it, actually.
That's
so,
enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is enough. If,
but they want to audit, and they're receiving a lot of resistance in Pennsylvania to looking at these votes.
Obviously, yeah. But here's the thing. If COVID was so bad that the election laws needed to be changed, then the legislature would have changed it. It's not like they didn't look at it. They looked at it and said, no, they'll be fine. That's what they looked at. And then they went and changed it anyways.
Yes.
The Secretary
of State
and
the Governor. And did it in a way that is so brazen to – yeah, I mean, listen, I said at the time that I don't understand where the Republican Party is, where the RNC is. You should have been on top of this and joining Trump, okay, and saying, listen, you had states out there who at the last minute changed the way they vote. That is in direct violation, okay, of not only the U.S. Constitution, but in many cases, state constitutions, right?
Right.
And you should have not certified those elections. I'm talking to you, Georgia, and Arizona, right, Pennsylvania. You shouldn't have certified those elections. What Trump was actually saying was, hey, wait, we need to take a look at this.
Okay,
so I have
so
another
one,
question I'd ask your lib friend real quick. Ask him, if it was such a great, clean election, how come we can't look? How come we can't just have a look, right?
Right. What are you afraid
why
of?
Why
right,
are they
right,
so
right,
insistent
right.
that we can't look at it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In Wisconsin, there was – I'm trying to see if I have that thing. I can't find it. It might be one of those other ones because I can't – I don't have a picture. But it's like a sheriff doing a press conference, and he's talking about
the
nursing home and the residents. And he said, you know, this is violations of the law, it is prosecutable. Yes. You know, he's saying that there's, if you certified the election illegitimately, that is in itself a crime and prosecutable.
It is.
And so we'll see where that goes.
I have said to people on the left that I know, and I don't talk to them much because it frustrates me, but I've said to them, listen.
I'm engaged
here, if you want to put this all at rest and we never talk about the 2020 election, let's look. That's all.
Even still.
Okay. You know?
I get you.
Yeah. So it's, I want something more to happen. But I think like I said last, I think it was not last week, the week before, when I was on it with G-Ski, I said the only way this is going to be coming, you know, common knowledge is just word of mouth. That's all we have is word of mouth. And it's,
exactly.
and the more people that are aware of it, that can, you know, articulate it, then it's just going to be slow going, you know, it might 90 seconds. Okay. So it might take 4 years, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean. But then, you know, what then? You know, you have thrown away a whole presidential term of 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
That was illegitimate. Do you
exactly.
reverse everything that president did? Do you...
If
you know,
were to
figure
out that the election was not legitimate, I believe the only thing you could do is say that anything that supposed president did was illegal. He wasn't the legitimate president of the United States. And I think that's something we talked about before.
He should go to jail for doing stuff as president.
Damn right you could. But the problem is, I talked about this earlier, if you pull this veil back, And Americans and citizens around the world see how things really work. I don't know if America or the world could handle it, Dave, if we really know what went on. That's why they're trying to suppress it so much, in my humble opinion.
Yeah.
Because the ramifications of that are fantastic, you know?
Well,
I
got like 10 seconds left.
Go,
buddy. We're gonna take it out. If you wanna hang out for a little while, we can still chat.
Let's chat, man. Well, I'm good. I'm just sitting here and doing stuff. But yeah, it's great. I hope the G-Ski is doing well. You know, he's my brother from another mother. We wish him the best. We'll put prayers out there in the ether for him. So
cool.
Let him know that if he's listening.
Well, he did tell me that his doctor changed a couple of things and he's doing a little bit better. So.
Is it the medical marijuana?
Just,
you can be honest with me, G-Ski. You're getting the medical marijuana? Come on, man. Come on, man.
Somebody that's not on the line is out. So thanks for coming, everybody, and we'll see you all next time. I think next week, but the week after, I think I have a gig. But the gig I have this week is on Sunday. My gig is on Sunday.
Okay.
So I'm looking forward to
nice.
That. I got some new equipment and kind of excited about having everything work out. It's,
going out there and doing your gig, That sounds fun, actually.
It's a Halloween gig, so it's great.
Oh, sweet. Yeah, okay, there you go.
I should
very
have a pretty
nice.
Good turnout. I've talked to a lot of people that said, oh, yeah, we're going to go. But sometimes, you know how that goes. Oh, yeah, I'll be there. And then you look around all night.
I'll be there. Yeah, I mean, it's, it's one of those things where I told my wife the other day, I said, I miss kind of being on the shows there because you need a creative outlet. I think people like us, we need that. You know, you need to have something to put your energy into. We all go do our jobs and that's necessary and fine. But, you know, sometimes it was fun to just go on and create things, you know, like G-Ski did with his little game show you did with all that stuff. I still enjoy it. That whole Blog Talk Radio thing, the little commercial you did about the wives of Blog Talk Radio.
The team that we had for a few months, it was really, really good.
That why it's a Blog Talk Radio thing makes me laugh even today when you play it. It makes me laugh.
I thought about playing it. I was going to take a thought with it, but then the episode just ended. So I'm like, yeah, all right, we'll just chat.
Yeah, we'll just chat, dude. It's fine. Yeah. I mean, you know, we just have this situation where, you know, I was sitting here the other day talking to the wife about the old days. And, you know, I talked about doing shows and how I was over in Germany when I started. She was stationed over in Longsville when I started doing shows and how that progressed and how much I sometimes miss it. I don't know if I have the energy to do, you know, like what we used to do, all of us doing multiple shows a week and two, three
right.
hours at a time. But
right.
None of us do.
That's why, that's why I called you to say, hey, you know, maybe give me a call, give us some help. Because
the great thing about being on with you guys is it's like a trip down memory lane, you know, because, you know, you guys were some of the first ones that, you know, I hooked up with on that platform. And, for those people who ever listen to this stuff, we used to have some conversations. You know, you guys are really talented guys, and I was a neophyte. I didn't even know how to do half of the stuff in Blog Talk Radio, and then I started trying to find my own voice. You know how this is as an artist. You just try to find your voice and how you want to do things. And I realized pretty quick that I wanted to be the political version of Don Rickles. That's my goal. I'm still sticking by that because Don Rickles is a hero of mine.
Yeah, no, that works. And then lost it.
That's okay. I've had many CTEs over the years.
I was gonna say that something. I got a dog here that I'm petting because she just keeps.
I got my special needs dog over here as well. His name is Chester, and he is about 9 years old, and he's a special needs dog because he had a we got him from the shelter, and he ended up having a rare form of some kind of a – I don't know if it's a leukemia or if it was a trouble with his red blood cells, and he had to go to the doggy ICU for a while and get blood transfusions. And I swore to my wife years ago, I'm never going to spend a lot of money on a dog. I wrote a very large check for that day. I'm just going to say I'm a softie when it comes to the dogs. So,
but they get to you, man. I tell you what.
They do, and they're great.
My wife,
they're great
said,
companions.
Oh, you get another dog. We got two. We got a 9-year-old yellow lab right here, a head butt in my hand.
Right.
And then a 2-year-old golden. And then.
Sweet.
My son's in the background correcting me. She's 10.
I'm sorry.
And then she's 3.
You know, I don't know if you've ever seen it. I was going to tell you this the last time we were on, and I wanted to mention this to you, being that, you know, you work for the post office and such. Have you ever seen the movie Funny Farm with Chevy Chase? I don't know if you've ever seen that movie or not. There is a scene in that movie with a gentleman from the Northeast, like you are, who has a rural mail route. And let's just say he's rather unique in the way he delivers the mail. And every time I watch the movie, I think, is that Dave? Is that what Dave does? And he comes along at 60 miles an hour and throws the mail out the window. I mean, I don't know if that's you, but every time I watch that, I laugh thinking, is that Dave? Is that what Dave does? He's got that much more of a wicked Northeastern accent than you do, but still.
Yeah.
If you ever see the movie, watch it.
Tell
me my cost.
Park my cost plenty.
That's it. So, you know, it's just as much that thing where we were talking about Blog Talk Radio in the past and all the people and, you know, that we came across over the years. But you and, you know, G-Ski, I remember him being a workaholic animal. He would put on multiple programs, you know, 2-3 hours a show, just go forever.
Yeah, he really would.
And, incredibly talented man.
That's why he loves the Wives of BTR promo because he got a lot of that stuff. That hit.
Well,
home.
First of all, you encapsulated all of it in there. You know about how it's you know. You're making any money doing that? Not really. No.
You better come and eat. I'm not bringing it in.
I'm not bringing it in there to you. You loser. Right? Yeah. But you know, we talk about that though. But it was important because you know, we needed that outlet, I think. I think that's what kept a lot of us sane during the Obama years. And now during the Biden years is just to have an outlet for some of our frustrations and our concerns.
You're absolutely right.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's like last week, you know, on Friday at about probably 2 or 3 o'clock, you know, he says, hey, I got this thing. You're going to be by yourself tonight. And I'm like, all right, no, put up a best of or something because I don't have time to be by myself. So he let me know a little earlier today that he wasn't going to be able to be here.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, what was the thing? I had a couple of things that I wanted to, you know, go through and look up and talk
you
about.
You know, it's
just need time to do
I
that.
Heard. Yeah, you did a great job. You always did with the stuff, and you know, bringing up the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist stuff. I think, and I don't know if enough people have really delved into those both of those sets of papers, which they should. And I think that's interesting that, you know,
Dana, do me a favor, not that I'm vain or anything, but you broke up that whole last bit.
Mm.
You broke
I
up.
I said that one of the things that I enjoyed about when I first came on the air was you doing the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist papers, because I don't think enough people have read those papers, both sides of the position, which
there's
of course,
plenty I have yet to read too. You know, hit them all, but I mean, I hit, you know, the ones that relevant to what I was writing about.
I think you recognized early on, I think what we did, and this was years ago, which I shun to think about how many years ago it was when you and G-Ski and I first met. It's been a long time, but we realized at the time that the country was lurching towards this position that we find ourselves in now. Now, I don't think any of us were prescient enough to understand when that day was going to come. But I think it's fair to say that day is here, that you and I and G-Ski have proven right, that we're here now and we have to do something about it. And whether it's doing a show, which I think is incredibly important to put your information out. And listen, if you change the position or give one person information they didn't already have, I think you've done a great service for society. And I'm not being grandiose when I say that. I truly mean that. Giving people information that they can't get from the mainstream media, I think is incredibly important. And so if one person took your words earlier today, Dave, and runs with it and actually goes and looks at the Federalist Papers, which, by the way, people are in public domain. You can get them for free. That's what I mean. Go read them and go read the Anti-Federalist Papers, because as I told you earlier, would you ever have thought early on in your political thinking that you ever would have said, man, I think I might be on this Anti-Federalist guy's side, a little bit at least. Because I think I am. I think I know what they were saying now, right?
Well, right. You're absolutely right. Because what – okay, just thinking about this right now, the way you brought it up, the way you presented it, I don't think I thought about it like that. But here's my reaction. My reaction to that is this. First of all, the Federalists did a good job of explaining the reason – for everything that was in the Constitution.
Right.
The Anti-Federalists did a good job of explaining what human nature would do with that. That's my reaction to just having for the first time, you know, juxtapose the two the way you just presented it. And that's my reaction.
It's just studying Marx. It's studying, you know, the fact that this man was a reprobate and that this man was a loser. And he takes these ideas and he's put it into writing that has poisoned the minds of thousands of other people who look, you know, you and I know this is true. Marxism does what? It is to go after those people who feel they are disaffected by society, right? Those people who feel they're on the outside looking in. Right?
Marxism at its base divides.
Exactly. That's what we have the critical theory, right? Marx put people in classes. These people put people into racial identities. But it's to separate
and
us
classes,
from the individual
and
human.
That the race thing is on top of the base that was set. So it's
what
all
is
there.
More soulless than to tell a person they are not an individual. Everything that they are is assigned to a class. What is more soulless than that? which is why I call it satanic in its nature. And, yeah, and I think, I, you know, we need to be more clear about this so people understand what we're talking. It's an evil ideology. There is no middle ground. There's no – this whole idea of social democracy. Are you kidding me? Socialism – and this is not me saying this, okay? Socialism was a way station to what, Dave? To communism. It was just a way station. I mean, it's that incrementalism that we go through, right? And so I dismiss all of it. Okay, that's why I tell everybody, I don't care what you call yourself, you're a communist. I don't care if you call yourself a social democrat, whatever you want to call yourself, you're a communist.
Because the reason it goes to communism from socialism is because the socialism has to be enforced. There, there's your communist.
There you go.
And by whom, right?
There you go.
So aren't the
And so when we talked about this, listen, it was. You remember when we were on the fringe, right? So we were back in the day when we were all doing our own shows and we were talking about this stuff. People thought we were on the fringe, right? We were out there. We were far right, whatever kind of label they wanted to slap on us. But damn it, we were right. Okay, we saw what was coming, and I admit fully it was because I had great teachers, right? I consider Mark Levin to be one of the most brilliant men ever. And then he introduced me to some guy named Thomas Sowell who blew my mind, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Thomas Sowell, a former socialist, by the way. He's a brilliant man and just blew my mind. So,
well, don't forget
me to the Austrian
Freeman,
school.
Ronald Reagan, you know.
Oh, Ronald Reagan.
Buckley.
We miss Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
But listen,
Milton
Dave, you know, you and I, you and I have been down this road and. You know, the concept of individual liberty is such a fantastic idea. And the fact is, this is the only time it's ever been tried. Our founders were brilliant men, who are now, they're dismissed.
Well, it took like 100 years for people to think up an argument against it.
This idea of natural law, right, that there might be some rights. And may I say this, too? For you people listening who may be on the left, if you're monitoring this program, do you know that there are some rights that you have no business giving away because you can't, right? They're God-given rights. You and I have gone down this road before, right? There are certain rights that no matter if I ascend to the government, fine, I'll give up my rights. You can't. They don't belong to you, right? They're universal God-given rights. You can't give them away, people, right? It's a mind-blowing idea, but you can't give them away.
I just wrote something. I just wrote, hold on. Something I wrote about. I got to get to this. In my Think for Yourself. This will be on the podcast, but I didn't get to it live. Arguing with somebody who disagrees about, you know, whatever they're about Marxism. Only they won't admit.
Right.
What's more important to you, collective rights or individual rights? Do you want to leave the opportunity to have to disagree with what the collective decides are rights?
Right. Fantastic.
Unalienable rights are rights that cost no one else anything.
That's a brilliant point.
Yeah. All right. So, I copied and pasted this from my second one. So instead of following the statement of, quote, the good of the many outweighs the good of the few or the ones, you might remember that from a Star Trek movie.
That's right. Spock. Yes.
Yes. Why not create conditions where the maximum amount of ones can create the best good for themselves, thus allowing them the freedom to give or otherwise help out any needy in their family or anywhere close to them. Doing this would certainly create the most good for the most amount of people possible. The conditions would have to include altering what children learn about this topic in school and electing politicians who can educate the public about this. And finally, the media needs to be on board with the message. The media is probably the most important in this cause because they are the entity most responsible for where we are today. They
I believe
know
this. Yes.
How to do it. And using the same
CNN.
Technique.
Yeah.
Okay, so using the same technique of repeat, 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 nudge, encourage, repeat some more, but supporting patriotism instead of ridiculing it. In other words, the same way the poison was introduced into our culture, use the same
right.
techniques to bring in some truth and purity. I guess I'm being polyamorous.
Well, that's a great point. CNN to me has become performance art at this point. I mean, it's not even media. I see what comes out of
not
that organization. I'm like, wow, that's really yeah. So, I mean, yeah, you can't trust anything. And it's not just, you know, I told my wife the other day, I'm a big sports fan as well. So it's every media, whether it's sports media or news media designed to, here's the narrative and we're going to shove it down your throat. Okay.
Yep.
There's no more reporting or honest journalism that goes along. It just doesn't happen anymore. People have an agenda and they push that agenda.
Yep.
Exactly. Exactly. And we don't have – look, the visceral reaction to President Trump is that President Trump was not a politician, right? So when he would
right.
say things and do things, they didn't know what to do with that when he called people fake news, right? Listen, I don't know anybody out there right now. I'm jonesing for a Donald Trump press conference. You remember those? I used to be actually
just
turn those on, Dave.
Just give me a minute.
Come
meme,
on. I mean – I miss the man so much being in the White House. You have no idea. Because he drove those people nuts because he wasn't your standard politician to give that answer that you want to hear. You know,
yeah.
sometimes he would just call you out and, you know, telling
right.
that NPR reporter, like, nobody really likes you, right? I mean, that's brilliant.
That's great.
I mean, I miss that. I really, really do. And I think that's why
think
they didn't know what they had to get
have...
him out.
What do you think about people who say you have orange skin? You know, nobody likes you.
Nobody likes you, and you know what? You're a doo-doo head, and go away, okay?
You're
everybody
ugly, and
your
mother dresses you funny.
Like, it's like, you know, Donald Trump grew up on the streets of New York and played the cut game, right? You know, like the Your Mama game, right? You know,
yeah.
he just knows how to do that. And these people have no idea because they've never dealt with anything. You're like, we got to get him out of there because we don't know what to do with him, right?
Because that's not
it.
Presidential.
So it's, to me, it is. What's more
it
presidential? Is
it
more presidential to do that, or did Andrew Jackson really try to beat someone to death on the White House grounds? Because I think he did, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there are things
aim.
That go along.
Right.
Yeah.
He did that. He did that in the Senate.
Yes.
He did that
in
the Senate so that there's no rules against that. So.
I mean, there is nothing better than the pearl-clutching media when he would go off on them, like the Jim Acostas of the world, you moron. I think I got time for you people. And that's what Trump was. He represented our viewpoints, right? We don't got time for this. I ain't got time for this nonsense. We got business to take care of. Hey, anybody out there who didn't vote for President Trump, did you stop at the gas station today? How you liking it, right? How are you liking what's going on right now?
I said at the beginning of the show, I'm officially pissed off at the world. And I don't talk to anybody that I know voted for Biden because I'm paying $65 to fill up my friggin' tank.
I bet you are. And, you know, it's just amazing to me that you have people in the White House who look at a problem so they don't see the root causes. Why do you have a supply chain problem? Because you make every wrong choice possible, right? Get out of the way and let the free market do what it does, okay? That's all that you have to do.
Probably about a year ago, I injected, you know, I injected this idea that when the government, by paying, the COVID thing, by paying people not to work, you have injected yourself into every industry and competing with every industry, but you're not producing anything.
Not a damn thing. And by the way, anybody want to be $500,000 to be an illegal immigrant family who's been separated? I mean, are you insane?
I thought about that one today.
Come on.
I'm going to give that a minute. I think that's going nowhere. Before I, you know, before I clutch my own friggin' pearls. I'm not going
to
worry.
Well, I'm just going to say to you, the idea that you even float that idea, okay, is insane.
No, I agree.
So here's what they're really saying, Dave. Hey, listen, we know we disrupted your entire life last year and destroyed your business. Here's a $2,000 check. Hey, did you cross the border illegally and we separated you from your parents? Here's $500,000. That's what they're saying.
$450,000 check, yeah.
Which, by the way, we don't have anyway because it's just invisible money that we don't really have. Okay, we're just printing it. Hey, people, if you're out there right now, Google Weimar Republic. Just Google that and get back to me later, and you'll see what I'm saying about what's going on right now. Inflation to me, you know this. You've been to the gas pump. People have been to the store, right? I keep track of what I buy and just keep track of the cost. And just the basic necessities, at least in my area, have gone up in 6 months more than 40%, Dave, at the grocery store. 40%. Now, fortunately, my wife and I'm not complaining. We make a good wage. But what about those poor people out there, young couples, got children? How the hell are they making it today is my question. And we're not concerned about that, right?
No, it's choices. But then again, some of them are getting that family tax credit, which is an extra $300 or $400 a week, a month.
That's true. That is true. That is true. But I mean, I don't know what
you're bragging about that. I'm like,
except you and I, who've been warning these people for decades or more, stop doing this nonsense, right? Stop it. But yes, I mean, to me, the thing about the one thing that I do take heart in, and we've been kind of negative in many ways, but here's the positive of it. You know, I met you and G-Ski years ago, and I didn't know you guys. I've never met you in person. But, you know, there's other like-minded individuals out there, right, besides just you and me and G-Ski. Know that we're not the only ones out there. When you're sitting at home at night and you're discouraged, you're not the only person who thinks this way, okay? The actions you can take are very simple. Some of us do what you guys did, start an internet radio show. Hey, start a blog. Hey, maybe go to your school board meeting, right? Get involved in some way. I believe people do make a difference, Dave. I don't want to be totally negative throughout the whole show. People can make a difference, okay? Take an action. You never know who you're going to influence. Talk to your coworker. Talk to your child who maybe is in college right now being indoctrinated, God bless their hearts, right, being in college today.
Yeah.
But don't be totally negative. I don't want to do that because I do believe this is still the greatest nation on God's green earth.
I can't wait to get to Chapter 7 of American Marxism. I bought the book. I'm on Chapter 2.
You got the book? Yeah.
Yeah, it's slow going for me because I don't have a lot of time to read or read a little bit.
It took me hard on a couple chapters. For those people who don't have the book, can we at least agree Levin's a genius? Can we agree with that?
Oh,
you and I. And he doesn't write dumb books. Like, he doesn't dumb it down for you and I. He wants you to be challenged by it. There's a couple chapters that were challenging. Yeah.
So that's why it's taken me a long time. It's not because I'm dumb. It's just because, you know, it's like the end of the day. I'm going to read a little bit before bed.
Right.
I'm going to read the same page like two or three times sometimes. You know,
how long did it take you? Just for instance, how long did it take you to get to that critical theory chapter? Because it took me a while.
I'm not there yet.
It took me a while to get through that, to understand what he actually is. As he ties it back to Marx and everything that's going on, it takes a bit. It's like Ameritopia. If you read Ameritopia, that's another book that, man, it takes you a while to get through because there are some big concepts in that book.
I don't have that
it's
one,
a
but,
great
he,
book.
But he has said that's probably his deepest
He talks a lot about philosophy there. He breaks down Locke. He breaks down Socrates, Aristotle. And I mean, for someone like you and I, who we didn't go to college with I went for a medical degree. I didn't go for, you know, a classic education. It was a bit to get through, right? But it's important to get through that. And he does it in a way that, he's not pandering to you at all. There's no doubt about that. But if you haven't got American,
I
want
to get to the point. I want to get to the point, you know, that you just mentioned, because a lot of that intersects with, and you know, in a way, I guess I'm looking for a little validation from him, because that would be, how cool is it to be validated by, you know, Mark Levin on the things
somebody
that I wrote
respect,
when, when I, you know, when I stumbled across critical theory and how that started and where, you know, where it came from and how it evolved, you know, going through the Sigmund Freud type of thing and the other guy, the, the nephew there that, that did the father of PR, I can't think of his name right now.
Right.
But, you know, it, it all went through that. And then each person brought to the whole critical theory, they brought a different, they brought just a slightly different thoughtful, you know, from their point of view, thoughtful aspect to the thing, which shaved away on the diamond that they're crystallizing, shaved away another facet of the, you know, how, hey, this will make it work better. Boom. Okay. We'll trim that other stuff
right.
off. Boom. This will make it work better. Boom. This will make it work better. Boom. This will convince more
right.
people. Boom. This is how to get people to not oppose it. You know, boom. This is
right.
So, you know, so that, so they inject all these things. And what they're doing is they're crystallizing this theory
right.
when it's still a theory.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah, listen, I don't think you – I think you've been validated in many ways. You're probably familiar with – and I got this from Levin as well, as a guy named Eric Hoffer, who was a longshoreman, for God's sake, who wrote on political theory. The man was brilliant. Look, you don't have to go to college, Dave, and study philosophy and political science to get it, right? You know, when you were putting your stuff together years ago, you understood the concepts, you understood the threat, and you put it in your own words, which is kind of what Hoffer did when he was talking about, like, mass movements and stuff, right?
Yeah.
And so it doesn't take a college degree to understand this stuff. It doesn't. It takes an instinctual sort of viewpoint on like you talked about earlier, human nature. You know, this idea of disaffected people in society, let's pick on those who are weak and disaffected and we'll get them to our cause, we'll rally them to our cause, and they'll be our little army that becomes the BLM people of the world and the Antifa people of the world who have no idea what they're rallying against, right?
Right.
So, you know, don't take that away from yourself. I only mentioned Levin because that was the first person who I actually heard on the radio who talked about what I thought was really substantive stuff, right? Like
yeah.
philosophy and John Locke and the whole bit. So, you know, but your stuff early on was quite impressive. I think you boil it down. You got it. There's no doubt.
Yeah. Well, that's very kind. Appreciate that.
Hey, listen, I don't throw praise around because there are some people out there who are grifters in this business, okay? Whether they be politicians or they're on the radio or write books or whatever, they're grifters. They don't believe in what they actually are writing about. I always got the idea that you believed completely in what you said. You and G-Ski, listen, you guys said it. You meant what you said, and there was no wavering on that. You haven't gone back on it. You haven't decided that, oh, okay, well, you know, maybe a little socialism is okay, right?
Yeah.
It's like, absolutely not.
Right.
Yeah. And it's just, it's one of those things where you have to be consistent, and you have been over the years. We know there's been some grifters, even in the early days of our internet experience with names we shall not mention, who ended up being big grifters, right? Who ended up being people who were not who they said they were. You guys have been completely consistent with that over the years. And, you know, I, as I said about the old days of Blog Talk Radio, it was a learning experience. I think we all learned from it. And you guys came back, you and G-Ski, a little more streamlined. You kind of know a little bit more than you did before. And I think that's the way it goes. I think if I were to come back, I would do it different. I've learned. Yeah, that there are certain people you can trust and certain people you can't, right?
One of the things that he and I talked about when we were, you know, because, oh, yeah, we're going to have a radio show. Okay, here's the thing. I don't have time to do show prep. So we'll get on there and we'll vent
right.
our spleens. And we agreed to do
right.
that.
Right.
But
listen,
you know,
show prep sucks to people out there who've never done a show, right? It sucks, right?
Well, the good news for me is I've got like two whole books that of material,
right?
That I can that I can use from. And that's kind of what I opened with today. You know, two different categories, two different chapters is talking about, and so that kind of saved me. But I still got to look that stuff up, you know, and find
just remind me the first book was when, because that was a while back, right? You had written that when
2010 was when that was published.
Oh my God, has it been that long? Holy crap.
The Tea Party awakened in 2009 and grew to a fever pitch in time for the 2010 midterm election. Some say in the nick of time. Well, I'm reading my back cover. Well, I say that at least. Many didn't know how we got so deep so fast. After all, Obama was a once-in-a-lifetime president, the chosen one. What happened? Obama has the ability to speak so convincingly and vaguely that he presented himself as, quote, all things to all people, unquote.
Right.
Even if he didn't intend to, he knew that's how he was coming across, and he did nothing to correct it.
Wow.
And I write, this is the back cover of Stay Mad. Throughout this book, there are examples of clues and evidence about how this country got to where she is and took a little over a generation to get here, and it will take the same to get back, except now we're fighting uphill against those who have brought us to this point.
Where did the years go, my friend?
Yeah, I know.
Where did they go? Wow.
So,
I mean,
both of my books came out at, like, midterm time, so they're, like, 4 years apart. So the second book was 2014, I guess. Right? 2014.
Yeah. Wow.
So
you know what? I just sometimes I sit here and I mean, I do wonder where the hell do the years go, right? Hmm. Where does it all go? You know, they pass by so quickly as you get older. My dad used to tell me all the time, "Hey, listen, when you get older, the years are going to go by so much more quickly." And I don't know if it's because we work so hard as we get to be adults and we have, you know, children in homes to take care of and whatnot, but man, does it go back quickly. So it's hard to believe that. But, you know, the one thing I will say is that I always thought highly of you and G-Ski, and I don't know if Steven Vandergast, the voice, many people remember him from the old days. He was an interesting character with a voice. His voice was from God. I swear to God, that man had a radio voice. But there, you know, I've always thought, even when we weren't communicating, that, you know what, I always wondered, hey, what the hell is Dave and G-Ski doing? You know, even those long periods of time where I went kind of radio silent.
You're talking, but it's not coming through. It's blipping and blopping. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if you can hear me.
The NSA.
Yeah, it's probably the NSA.
I can hear you.
Do you have any communication with Steven?
I have not. Actually, don't have any. The last time I talked to Steven was probably 2013. He was going, and the last time I talked to him, he was actually going to broadcast school. He was actually trying to be an official radio announcer. So
nice.
That's the last time I heard from him.
Well,
and
I'm just thinking he might be a good person to, you know, to get on and an interview, you know, or just
oh my God,
around.
Yes. Yeah, I haven't talked to him in years. You know, it's just one of those things where, you know, you kind of lose touch with people and everybody goes their separate ways. But he was one of my favorites when he was on. You know, it's the old group that we used to have. For those people who don't know, who might be listening to this later, we had quite an interesting group of people who used to do some shows together and populate each other's programs. But it really started for me meeting you and G-Ski, really, years ago. But I remember those conversations that we had, and you guys were kind to me in the beginning and kind of showing me a little bit about how this stuff actually works. And
well, when I first, you know, when I first, I'm, first heard you, okay, so from my perspective, I was already kind of sold on like Mark Levin. Okay, I had listened.
Yes. Yeah.
I had listened to all the others, and I had been listening to all the others, and each has, you know, their own. But as far as if I could really only have time to listen to one guy, that's the guy
that's it
was. Okay, because he offered the most and the deepest and you know the most complete historical. Because I was, you know, I was into learning about history at the time, American history and stuff like that. Oh, he knows it, you know. And
oh boy,
when I heard some of your shows, either on the podcast or listening live or whatever it was, I could hear the influence of Levin.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I could be like, oh, I know. I bet I know where he got that. You know, I could tell that you were, a listener of the, just by the way you presented a concept or, you know, whatever it was.
Absolutely.
I could bet that this guy got that from Levin. I think we'll get along fine.
I was a backbencher. That's what I was at the time.
Yeah.
I think what you do when you I did stand-up comedy for a while. So to give people an insight, you know, you have to find your own voice. So initially when you go to perform, and it may be the same way in music. I don't know if this is true or not, but you tend to imitate people who have influenced you in some way, right? So when I was in, you know, doing stand-up comedy and, you know, at the time, I'd actually had the privilege of actually meeting the late, great Sam Kinison. And, you know, he had a great influence on me because he actually took a half an hour out of his time to give a young, unknown stand-up comic a lot of advice. Okay. I was trying to imitate people. And then I realized as you move on, and as I said, it might be the same way in music, you start to find your own voice and the way that you want to do things. And it was really RZ, if you remember the great RZ back in the day, who actually gave me the term, which I believe kind of covers me, which is raconteur. I'm a storyteller, right? I'm going to tell you a story. And it may be in a certain way, right? As I said, I had many influences. Don Rickles, one of my favorite comedians of all time. And to do it in a way that kind of – you find your own voice. In other words, you might have influences, but you find your own voice. And early on, one of my great criticisms of myself was, hey, I'm doing too much Levin, right? I need to find my own way of doing things. And that's why today, ironically, and I'm sure you feel the same way, you mature and probably are better equipped to do a show today than you were 10 years ago, right? Because you've learned, and you've learned your own style and your own voice.
Yeah. And not only that, I've been listening to, you know, different talk radio all through, you know, it's not like I dropped off everything for the last 10 years. It's like, you know, you develop a, you know, whatever it is. As far as in music go, let me speak to that. What I do, it's the show that I do is, It's called MIDI, and what that is it triggers backing tracks from the keyboard. So it's like it's like a player piano. You know how a player piano works with a scroll?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So basically, what you've got is 16 scrolls that you can assign different instruments to. Okay. So it's not just a piano sound. If you had a player piano style trumpet, you know, that would play the trumpet sound. So that's basically what I'm working with. So I can assign different sounds to different tracks. So I have 16 tracks, 16 instruments that I can work with. And what I do is I'll download off the internet different MIDIs from different sites, you know, and if I can use it, then I'll use it. If it's not something that, that if it's not something that is usable for me, then maybe what I'll do is I'll pay for it. You know, I'll pay, you know, $5-$10 for a decent version or a professional version of, you know, these scrolls. But what I'll do is, and I've worked with other musicians who mm-hmm. who will need the original recording to learn the song. And what I do is obviously all the songs that I do are well-known songs, okay? So it's not like this is out of the blue. So I learn the song and practice the song to the MIDI so that I'm not mm-hmm. influenced and not I'll get a lyric sheet and the chords and I'll play along and I'll sing it according to the lyrics, and I'll make them fit my way. I don't sing it exactly right. The way. I mean, most of it comes out exactly the way the artist did it, but if it doesn't, to me, this is not the end of the world. I mean, that's just my version of this cover. You know, I'm covering this.
Mm-hmm.
So, right. So the musicians that I've worked with that won't use the MIDI to learn the song because they need the recording, I never understood. That's why I'm working alone now, as a matter of fact. You know, because just learn it to the MIDI, because this is what we're going to be playing to, you know. Learn to work with that, you know. And they say, oh no, that's not the way the song goes, the MIDI is slightly different than the song. So what? This is our version of it, you know. So,
this is your version, right?
That's what I'm saying. That's why
I think in comedy it's more of the style, the delivery, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Watch people over the years that you really admire, and you see their delivery. So early on when you get on stage as a comedian, not that this interests your political audience at all, but when you get on stage, you tend to want to emulate those people, right? So you may deliver a line like Rickles, or you may deliver a line like the late great Sam Kinison. But then you realize that, listen, I got my own way of doing this, right? I got my own way of saying things. And for me, and you'll understand this, I'm sure, my style is more of a stream of consciousness, right? I'll get on a subject and I just want to talk about it, and I'll just go. Okay, just go and go. I don't know where the end is going to be. It doesn't matter, right? And so that's kind of where I am on that. And it's the same thing that you're talking about. Like, it's your style. Like, I may take my own different take on this. It's okay. We can do this. So, you know, that was my learning curve when I went through Blog Talk Radio. Was like, yeah, you start out, you want to be Levin. Then you realize, well, you know, I got to be myself, right? I got to be who I am. And I got to have my own unique voice. And I think right now, as I struggle with this about, hey, should I come back? Should I do a show again every once in a while or not? Is that idea that are people ready for the style that I'm going to present? Because I got a feeling I'm going to upset some people. Okay.
Well, I think that should be, honestly, from me to you, should be the least of your worries.
It's just that, you know what, like I said before, we talked earlier, listen, I'm not on team whatever anymore. I want people to stand up for what's right. And, not that Democrats ever do. So it's not like I'm ever going to support a Democrat, because they never stand up for what's right. But you people on the right, you people who are Republicans, stand up for what's right. I don't
what
care
do you mean,
what,
you people?
What happens.
What do you mean by
you
saying?
People. Well, you people. Yeah.
Hey,
you
so,
people.
So,
I got that. That
so
was
listen.
A reference.
All right. So listen up. Okay, you can do, if you want to come back and do a show, you can do a half hour show for free.
Sure.
Okay.
I know that. Yeah.
What I would do if I were you is talk to G Ski and see if you can grab another night. Cause he's doing paying an account here for 7 nights a week.
Ski. First of all, let's talk about G Ski for a second, because I think I feel the need almost that I'm going to be the serious Jerry Lewis for a minute. You remember the serious Jerry Lewis that used to come on the telephones and we talk about G Ski, and the man is awesome. His talent is above board. If people don't know, this man is a musical genius. He certainly, as we know, was a great talk show host and could put together some bits that you play that one tonight. I love that bit with the former president of the United States. He's an immensely talented man. And that's what I loved about him when we would do the old shows. He would do 3 hours. You remember those shows, right?
Yeah.
He would cut 3 hours, for God's sake, which is not easy to do for people who've never done this stuff, right, to do 3 hours of material.
If I were you, I would contact DC and say, hey, we're doing another night, different night that you guys do or something.
I would love to maybe think about coming back and doing some things, but I don't want to put anything on G-Ski Station. Listen, I'm very out there right now. My viewpoint's pretty
fine.
Extreme in some positions.
Fine.
I'll be honest with you.
Listen,
you know,
fuck you then. Get your own show.
Oh, I'm just telling you. You don't understand. It's the thing about the wonderful thing about. This it's kind of a we talked about this earlier about how we have better ideas, we do better shows, we certainly meme better than the other side. I can tell you that for sure, and that's why they come for us, because we do this better than they do. We just do. And whether it's the old bits that you guys play, which I miss those days so much of being on the radio with you guys and doing our shtick. We had a bit, you guys remember this, whoever listened to the old shows, where, G-Ski and I were, and you were like this as well. It's like we were just a trained comedy group where you guys would bring me in and I would have to find some unique way of coming into the show, right? Whether it was acting like I'm talking to somebody off stage, whatever it was. And it was just like natural. The way that worked. And there was a peak of time when we were doing shows where I thought to myself, this is good as anything I hear on the radio or I see on TV. It was really, really good stuff. So, kudos to you guys for doing that. And for the other people who used to participate in those shows as well, God knows, I don't know what happened to all of them. It's been a while, but I hope they're still doing well out there. Our regulars that we used to have. Yeah.
Well, if you come across Stephen Vandegast, he might be an interesting guest to bring back
he
on.
He is
interested in.
I'm just telling you, if there was any man destined to be on the radio, it was Stephen Vandegast. That voice was unique. Certainly unique. And the rest of us who suffer by comparison, we used to – listen, we hated Stephen Vandegast for that voice. Let's be honest. We hated him deep down inside.
I did. I did. I could have. I'm on my equipment here, and I'm doing voice transpositions and trying to subtly, deepen it and stuff like that.
Yes, do the thing where I just –
Still not Steven. He just
nothing. No filter is going to help this voice. It's very nasal. It's horrible for radio. But Stephen Vandegast would drop that bass down and just.
Oh,
it was the voice of God. I swear
great.
To it. Just. Yeah, he was great, and all the old people that we used to have on the shows, and all of our listeners who I don't know if they still listen or not, but God bless all of them who were so loyal, who would come to the shows.
If you ever get a hold of Steven, I'm gonna just ask him, to do some scripts and then just secretly record him.
God, yeah. Do that thing where he would come in with a voice,
I know.
And it's just one of those things where, with such a unique group of people, I learned a lot from everybody, and I miss those days, Dave. I really, really do. It was time to. I swear to God, you and Dave, you and G-Ski and I swear to God, I'm just going to say this. I don't care what it takes. At some point, we're going to sit down together in a room. I don't care where it is. And by God, we're going to meet in person before it's all over with.
Well,
that is my hope and my dream.
I'm totally fine with that. I'm going to Rhode Island tomorrow.
On purpose?
My wife's from Rhode Island, so,
I actually spent a few months working a contract in Providence, so I've been to Rhode Island. I do know.
So, she had a cousin that passed away down there.
Oh,
So we're going down there tomorrow. So, and then Sunday,
so
I got a Halloween.
I lived in Seekonk, Massachusetts. The Seekonk. It's me.
I know that.
What a great experience that was. Yeah.
You did a lot of car parking.
Well, I'm sorry for the loss. I don't mean to make light of that. I'm sorry to hear that.
My
condolences.
So, right. For her, I think I met the guy maybe twice. So, I mean,
it's like, listen, for the wife, it's okay. But firstly, I don't give a crap. That's where you are. I love that about you.
Am I supposed to deny that?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
Dana,
you wouldn't have testosterone running through your bones. So,
I know.
Yeah.
Listen, it's been a slice. I really appreciate
it
when I can call on you and you know,
anytime, brother, you guys need it. And real quick out there to G Ski, like I said before, feel better, my brother. We're praying for you out here. Get well. It's not the same when you're not around.
He's not sick. He's just out to dinner with his daughter's birthday. So,
well, for God's sake, if I'd have known that, I'd have said no. Then the hell with him. Then that's what I say. No, seriously.
I hope he's listening.
Seriously,
to the
you
end.
Guys, it's always a treat. Yeah.
All right.
Take care.
Well, listen, rock on, and until next time. Okay, buddy. Thanks again.
All right, my friends. We'll talk again soon. Take care.
All right. Bye.